Good morning. Can you turn your mics on, please?
All right. Good morning, everyone. We're so excited we have a full house. Thank you all for coming. The Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on October 11th, 2024, at 9:01 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C, Phoenix, Arizona. Can I have a roll call, please?
Robert Charles.
Here.
Christina Groves.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan.
Here.
Crystal Krieger.
Here.
Jose Luis Madera.
Here.
Adelisa Meek.
Here.
Dominic Miller.
Here.
Diane Palacios.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you. My name is Adelisa Meek. I'm a licensed professional counselor, a licensed independent addiction counselor, and the board's chairperson. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to please make sure that your phone is on silent or turned off. For your convenience, throughout the meeting, vending machines are right outside the room and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders. This is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. Please be sure if you are speaking on the record that you speak clearly and into the microphone. In order to protect privacy, please keep in mind if it is necessary to refer to a client or former client during the meeting, including if they are complainant, please use initials only. Thank you for turning the lights back on. At this time, I would ask my fellow board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Crystal Krieger, LMFT professional member.
Christina Groves, licensed marriage and family therapist, professional member.
Dominic Miller, LCSW professional member.
Diane Palacios, professional member, LPC and LIAC.
Dr. Lynette Hennigan, LCSW and LISAC.
Jose Luis Madera, LPC, professional member.
Holly Knapp, deputy director.
Allison Taylor, operations manager.
Jared Carver, enforcement manager.
Kobe Zavala, executive director.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board.
Thank you. Now we move to agenda item number 3 minutes. We have item 3A, B, and C. We have to table those because there's no quorum. Item 3D, September 6, 2024, general meeting minutes. Mr. Miller will abstain. And do I have a motion?
Hennigan moves.
Palacio second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Approved minutes. Next is item number 4, our consent agenda. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. Board members have reviewed all the material and the recommendations. We are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone here wishes to pull the matter. Pulling the matter means that you are a party to the matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and you would like up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you do wish to pull the matter, please raise your hand when it is called so I can take note of that. All right. 4A, cases recommended for dismissal. Maria Blair. Keith Brock. Efron Hollis. Joseph Jenkins. Dion Spooner. Danitza Valle. Do I have a motion to dismiss cases 4A, 1 through 6?
Palacios moves.
Hennigan second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We go to cases recommended for dismissal with letter of concern. I know that DeVito, Ms. Kruger, will recuse. So let me do that one first. Nicole DeVito, anybody here pulling? Okay, do I have a motion to dismiss with letter of concern?
Palacios moves.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. Thank you. I understand Stacy Fielding is being pulled. Okay, thank you. And then Madison Goza. Do I have a motion to dismiss with letter of concern item 4B3?
Groves moves.
Hennigan second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Oppose? Okay, motion carries. So we go to 4B2, Stacy Fielding. And first, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff. And then you're the complainant? Okay, then I'll invite you to address the board in just a second.
Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter is before you today because following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support a violation of unprofessional conduct, and the services being provided do not appear to be psychotherapy. However, the board may want to consider dismissing this complaint with a letter of concern based on the following. It is a professional's responsibility to ensure appropriate and ethical use and representation of a professional's credentials. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Any board members have questions for Ms. Avala? No questions. So the complainant, you can come to the front.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, this is the licensee, Ms. Fielding.
And I'm the representative.
Okay.
Sorry. I understand.
It's okay. So if we just for the record, is the complainant here for this case? Okay.
Okay. So you're pulling the case? Okay. Go ahead and have a seat and introduce yourselves and then we'll move forward. You can turn the microphone on. There you go.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I understand this may not be customary when a case is recommended for dismissal. Ms. Fielding's concern is, of course, the letter of concern, and if that letter is given to the complainant. Ms. Fielding was asked to assist a fellow member of her church congregation by providing supervision during her parent time. She was not asked or paid for to provide any type of diagnosis, assessment, or treatment, or to provide clinical supervision. This was actually a lay congregation request from her bishop to just provide support to a woman in crisis. I think we won't get into whether or not she violated the law or the rule by an act of unprofessional practice as that was found unsubstantiated. It seems that the board's concern was primarily with the letter that she wrote to the court on behalf of the woman in crisis, the victim of a domestic situation. In that letter, she told the court that the minor was exhibiting evidence of being returned to an unsafe environment. Ms. Fielding has substantial experience working with children, primarily on the San Carlos and White Mountain Apache reservations. And she included a synopsis of that experience to lend credence to her observation of the minor's behavior. There was nothing in that letter that held herself out to the court as acting within her official capacity as a licensed associate counselor to anyone involved in this family. It was very clear in the letter that she was acting at the request of her bishop to provide support in a lay congregate fashion. Furthermore, she never even considered the request to supervise this parent time to be one based on her training. Rather, again, it was part of a church culture to provide that support to a woman in crisis. And I feel that this is akin to the Good Samaritan laws in the medical field, where a doctor was sued for providing assistance to somebody in an emergency situation, which has resulted in a lot of legal support for people providing assistance in a moment of crisis. And Ms. Fielding has the experience, and as do all of you in this room, to provide that support to people who are struggling. And to suggest that they can't provide that support unless they are being hired to do so creates a public policy concern. This is somebody who wants to continue to provide support to this struggling woman, even if it's just giving her rides to court. She never testified in court. She never, upon our information and belief, that letter was actually never even filed with court. But rather, this is an attempt by the complainant to continue to attack everyone. This is the fourth person that the bishop has asked to help this woman who has been attacked by this man, to continue to control and isolate his ex-wife and gain an advantage in the domestic case. So our concern with putting a letter in of concern in her file and providing Mr. Heaton that ammunition is that he will continue to attack, and thereby Ms. Fielding has stepped aside for the last 4 months, has been unable to help this woman due to the attack on her livelihood and her credibility. And that's the concern, that if a letter is placed in her file, and she starts her career off with a disciplinary letter, and that gets to his attention, that he can further use it to continue to attack people that are trying to help this woman who's in crisis.
If I may say, just for the record, a letter of concern is not a disciplinary
Thank you.
In-law it is. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, may I get your name and spelling for the record, please?
Yes, Sue, S-U-E, Chrisman, C-R-I-S-M-O-N.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, thank you. It's a dismiss with letter of concern. Any questions for the licensee or her representative? No?
So what was that? You are still writing the letter of concern, or we are not including a letter of concern?
It's a case that is dismissed
with
a letter of concern and is non-disciplinary.
Okay. Does the letter go to the complainant, is, I guess, was our concern?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Because in a court hearing, he is absolutely going to file that and try to continue to make that an issue. And if she gives a ride to this woman to court or continues to help her in a non-behavior health professional capacity, he will absolutely continue to complain to you guys and continue to make this an issue in court. That was why Ms. Fielding has concerns about a letter being given to him and put in her record, even if it's not disciplinary, in a legal capacity in the courthouse. He's going to absolutely use that to continue to try to attack her professionally and personally.
Thank you. Any, no questions for the complainant? Licensee? All right. So this will be a time for us to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt.
Madam President,
yes,
members
ma'am.
Of the board. You're a lawyer?
I'm a
okay. All right. You need to
thank you.
Okay. So any feedback from board members? This is clearly non-disciplinary, right? It's a dismissal with letter of concern because there's some concern about the letter, right? I understand that the licensee acknowledged that the letter of support sounded clinical due to her training and might have given the impression of a professional opinion. And anybody else has any additional comments on this case?
I think when, we have, in as professionals, we also have different aspects of our life, right? Like a ministry aspect of our life. And so, but since we, as a licensed, professional, it's also that piece of you can't necessarily omit either. And so as we are going about our personal lives or even in our ministry life, to be able to separate that and just be very careful because it can be construed as you're writing on behalf of your professional training. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem like that was the intent in this case, but because the licensee has a license, it is being taken that way. And so, she wasn't acting on behalf of her profession, but it just gets really sticky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think too, as a professional and speaking from a ministry side of experience, we have an obligation to educate our pastor, ministry leader, whoever that is, and put policies in place to protect us and the ministry itself. So if that means having a clause and lay people sign it, understanding when I'm here, I'm operating in this capacity and I'm not operating in this capacity. And the liability lies with this person. And so just to kind of put that extra layer in, so when a lay person is meeting with you as a ministry person versus a clinical person, they understand your scope mm-hmm. and your range of what you're able to do.
So clear definition of roles.
Clear definition.
Okay.
End of the role.
Add one more thing to that, that when we start using our credentials in that, that's where it gets really sticky.
Right.
And that's one way that we can keep those separate is by not using our credentials in those situations.
Mm-hmm. All right. So any further discussion? I'm ready to make a motion.
Madam Chair, members of the board, and I'd like to point out two licenses, 3281H2. After the letter of concern and dismissal is issued, that the licensee would have 30 days to file this for that. And that would be part of the record.
Would that be part of what goes to the complainant?
No, it does not go to the complainant.
I was just curious. All right. Thank you. All right. So I move to dismiss this case with a letter of concern.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much for coming. Going back to item 4C, cases recommended for opening a complaint and dismissing with a letter of concern. Okay. I have Shelley Newman. All right. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and dismissing with a letter of concern?
Palacios moves.
Hennigan second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next is item 4D, cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. I have Cheryl Congrove, Amanda Higginbotham, Laura Nunez. Do I have a motion for recommending acceptance of proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement, items 4, D, 1, 2, and 4?
Palacios moves.
Madeira second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then I have item 4D3. Dr. Krieger recuses. Esther Del Pozo.
I just need to note that we have a previous professional relationship, but I feel comfortable voting.
Okay. Somebody raise a hand in the back. Are you pulling the matter? Did you hear? Okay. Thank you. Do I have a motion to accept a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement for Esther Del Pozo?
Palacios, go ahead.
Groves moves.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next one is for F. Cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. Thomas Wood. Christopher David. Are you Christopher? Okay, you're not pulling the matter, or are you pulling the matter?
I'm sorry, can you explain that?
Yes, to pull the matter means that you do not agree with the recommendation. Okay. Okay, sure, come to the front then. Let me just take a vote for Thomas Wood. Do I have a motion to accept the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
Palacios. Moves.
Madeira second.
Roll call, please.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madeira.
Aye.
Adelise Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
All right, thank you. Christopher David, can you turn the microphone on?
Is that on?
Okay. Yes, so go ahead.
Yes, my name is Chris David, and I'm a licensed professional counselor. I live out of Flagstaff, Arizona, so thank you for having me and the opportunity to speak to the board. First, I do take a full accountability for the violation of policy with dual relationships. I see that very clearly. I do have a few questions regarding the recitals on number 10. Can I state that concern or misunderstanding?
I'm not sure. I need some help here, Ms. Zavala.
Madam Chair, members of the board, and licensee. So this matter is before us to accept a signed consent agreement. And so these types of questions would be, should be directed towards board staff, as I don't always believe that the members may have the answers. I think you're welcome to hear them, but I think if he has questions in regards to what has been assigned and agreed upon, it would be better to reach out to myself or to the investigator.
To go back. Okay. So could you do that next week? Just reach out to Ms. Zavala or your investigator to ask your questions.
Sure. Can I ask who's my investigator on this particular case? Is it?
Not right now, because right now we're not, that's not on the agenda.
Okay.
Right. So do we just table this one?
No,
We have a signed consent agreement.
Got it.
So okay. There was just statements that wanted to be made. So we would want to move forward with the vote on this.
All right. So we're going to vote on accepting your signed disciplinary, your proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. And then you can call your investigator or Ms. Zavala tomorrow.
Thank you.
So do I have a motion to accept for a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
Hennigan moves.
Miller second.
Roll call, please.
Alisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank
you. Next is cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. Janet Arden. Tiffany Jones. Kim McReynolds. All right. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and accepting the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreements?
Groves moves.
Palacios second.
A roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Thank you. Next is 4I, cases recommended for release from consent agreement. And Mr. Madera will recuse from all of this. Do I have a motion to release from consent agreements, item 4I, 1 through 6?
Palacios moves.
Hennigan second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next item is agenda item 7. This is the time and place scheduled for board review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by us pursuant to the authority given in ARS 323281. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach deliberations. This list is not exclusive and there may be other options that the board considers. Board members have reviewed all of the materials submitted for each case. The board will first hear a summary of case from the board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information that the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that the board staff took to present the case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation. We ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is our time to talk amongst ourselves. Remember, if it is necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, please use initials only, including if they are the complainant. Please keep in mind that the board has a civility policy that prohibits disorderly conduct, and those in violation will be removed from the meeting. Before we begin, I want to advise you that this proceeding is being recorded. Accordingly, it is important that everyone speaks loudly and clearly, and that only one person speaks at a time. All right, so do we have the complainant on the phone for Brenda Venegas? Venegas? And we have the license. Okay. Licensee and counsel. Thank you. Is Maria Simmons on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Maria. My name is Adalessa Meek. I'm the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners Chairperson. And we're ready to address the case for Brenda Venegas. And just to let you know that this is a public meeting. It is being recorded. I'm sitting here with members of the public, board staff, and board members. So first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff. Then I will call you so you can address the board if you wish. And after that, the licensee will have time to address the board as well. So for now, if you can put your phone on silence, that would be great.
All right. Sounds good.
So, staff, can we listen to a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter was placed on the consent agenda for a letter of concern. However, the complainant did pull the matter, so that is why it's on the disciplinary side of the agenda. Following a review of the investigated record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support a violation of unprofessional conduct. However, the board may want to consider dismissing this complaint with a letter of concern based on the board's concern that that is a professional's responsibility to maintain professionalism in the workplace. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? No questions. Ms. Simmons, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay. So first, I would like to address the board by stating the initial intent behind filing this complaint. It was solely for the purpose of holding Ms. Venegas accountable for her actions on 3-5-2024. This decision came about throughout this ordeal, and finally when we were both terminated from employ at The Haven on 4-16-2024. I had discussed and vocalized considering this not only to my direct supervisor at the time, but also during the mediation, which took place on 3-18-2024. However, I was discouraged from taking any action against her by my direct supervisor, as this would affect her licensure with Ms. Venegas practicing under her license. On 3-18-2024, during the aforementioned mediation, when Ms. Venegas failed to take responsibility, lacking accountability, it was clear she was in turn lacking moral compass. For the absence of remorse or accountability on her part, the sense of feeling unsafe and fear of more severe retaliation from her grew. Therefore, on 4-11-2024, I took action to protect myself by filing a police report against Ms. Venegas for being assaulted on 3-5-2024. As I was advised by on 4-10-2024 by the quality compliance manager and the clinical director of services, was my right. I expressed fear of being terminated or what might happen in my doing so, and they both stated my employment at The Haven would not be in jeopardy. This escalated very quickly once I filed this report, as Ms. Venegas was contacted by law enforcement. Ms. Venegas not only lied to the officer, making me out to be the aggressor, she then decided she wanted to press charges against me and filed an injunction against harassment on me, citing our place of employment as a prohibited location. After being served with this at work on 4-12-2024, we were both placed on paid administrative leave and ultimately terminated on 4-16-2024. Once we were both terminated, there was no longer the risk of jeopardizing my supervisor's license, hence the delay in filing the complaint. Although I have been deemed by The Haven with the status as rehirable, Ms. Venegas was not extended the same status. I would like to add that during my time at The Haven, over 3 years as an employee, I had not ever had so much as had a verbal reprimand for anything or nor any disciplinary action taken against me. Ms. Venegas, however, in the short amount of time that she had been there, which was less than a year, from end of July 2024 to April 16, 2024, there had been at least 3 documented mediations with staff for her continued unethical behaviors toward not only staff but members alike. So I do understand this is being recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern and would like to request clarification as to what this entails, as I firmly believe Ms. Venegas would greatly benefit from additional and extensive coaching on her approach toward coworkers and members she provides services to.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for the complainant? Okay, there are no questions. So, Ms. Simmons, if you can put your phone on silence, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And now, Ms. Venegas, you and counsel.
Yeah, Jonathan Rothschild, counsel for Ms. Venegas. I'll be very quick and let Ms. Venegas have a moment. This complaint rose out of a dispute in the office between the two employees. There was a toxic workplace. I can tell you that Ms. Venegas was rehirable at The Haven. I can also tell you that she was ending a job with Palo Verde Hospital, which she subsequently received and is working there. Ms. Venegas had put out a list of patients that were going to be, or clients were going to be there that day. Ms. Simmons saw it, crumpled it up, went to Ms. Venegas' office, raised her voice with her. This is not the first time this happened. And Ms. Venegas apologized for putting out that was wrong, and she's apologized on the record for that as well. And asked Ms. Simmons to leave. Ms. Simmons would not leave. Ms. Venegas got up and closed her door. Ms. Simmons says she slammed the door. There's one witness, and you have the record for that, who says there was no yelling on Ms. Venegas' part, and there was no slamming of the door. Ms. Simmons did file a police report. You have that police report. The police report found that the complaint was unfounded. Ms. Venegas did file a restraining order because she had concern. That has been dismissed. There was a mediation and subsequent termination. Luckily for Ms. Venegas, she does have good employment. You have a letter from her clinical supervisor saying, A, she was a good employee, B, that there were no other that she knew of disruptions in the workplace with other employees. And Ms. Venegas has been a good clinician. There's been no complaints from patients. Ms. Venegas is prepared to accept the letter of concern, the dismissal with letter of concern. She was prepared to accept that. Of course, it's up to the board if they want to just dismiss it. Ms. Venegas, if you want to say a word or two.
So I do hold myself accountable for what started the incident, and I was actually very gracious with Ms. Simmons and thanked her for helping me prevent what could potentially have been a violation. What I can say is that I work very hard in my field to take care of my clients, and I know the importance of being responsible in the workplace. I did the best that I could that day to handle the situation with Ms. Simmons. I asked her repeatedly to please leave my office. She wouldn't. So I know Jonathan said I stood up. I actually rolled my chair over to close that door. This is how close my door is at the desk. I literally rolled my chair over to close the door. I did let her know that I was closing the door. And therefore, she had asked me to apologize for this in the mediation. I did tell her that I apologized for how she felt. However, for me to apologize for something I didn't do, I think it's evident here today what potentially that harm could have done for me to apologize for something that I know I did not do. I do not treat people with violence. I do not treat people in such a way that Ms. Simmons is describing my person today. I uphold my ethics and my integrity to a very high standard. And I believe you have a letter from a colleague that says that to you, and I've known her for years and years. So, and you have the letter also from my clinical supervisor, who was also the program director, who also sat over Christina. You have that letter as well, speaking to my nature as a therapist and the care that I gave to clients at the Haven. I work for Palo Verde, a partial hospitalization program right now. I feel awful that I'm not there today with my clients, as I had to have other people take care of them today. And so I would like to just move away from this and be able to continue in the care and the continuity of care that I give my clients every day. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much. Any board members have questions for Ms. Venegas? Okay, so there are no questions. So this is the time for board members to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. And Ms. Palacios, you're leading.
So, colleagues, I am in agreement with dismissing with letter of concern. It does not rise to clear and convincing, which is what we are trying to assess. And so if you are all in agreement with that, I make a motion to propose we dismiss with a letter of concern, but open to any of your thoughts as well.
I agree.
No comments? Do I have a second?
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. So we're dismissing with letter of concern. Thank you very much for coming and for attending. Ms. Simmons, we are now done with this case, and you're free to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I may I just say something very quickly?
Not anymore. Not anymore. Excuse me.
No. Okay.
We're done with the case. Thank you. All right. We now move to... I hope I said this name correctly. Enyang Udo Emma. Is the complainant here? Where? Oh, okay. You're the complainant coming in to the front. Oh, you're the licensee. Is the complainant here? Okay, complainant is not here, so licensee, you're free to sit there at the front. And if you can introduce yourselves, and then we'll listen to the summary from board staff.
My name is Iyang Ada Udoema.
Okay.
LPC.
Thank you.
And I'm Jennifer Wasserman, partner with the law offices of Davis Miles.
Thank you. So we can hear the summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client. This recommendation is based on the following. From approximately 123 to 623, licensee served as the clinical director with agency. Agency had a clinical facility and supportive housing location. Licensee represented the following. Licensee's contracted role was strictly to the clinic, and while there was crossover between the staff at the clinic and houses, he was not in charge of the houses. Agency had housing and staff that worked at both the clinic and housing. In 623, client passed away at one of agency's supportive houses. According to an access death report, this home appeared to have been unlicensed, sober living home, or group home environment. Agency's incident report for client, although written by technician, was unsigned by him and signed by licensee. It is concerning that although licensee claimed he did not have oversight of any agency supportive housing, he signed an incident report for events that took place at the supportive housing. Additionally, according to the access death report, agency identified technician as the staff member present during the incident and who completed the incident report. Technician's personnel record showed he applied for the position of house manager but signed a job description for and appears to have worked as a BHT for agency. Licensee represented the following. Licensee believes the individuals who worked at the clinic and housing did provide services such as group therapy, but it is blurry. As a case manager, technician was supposed to be a support to clients and assist them with their needs. Technician participated in clinical supervision because licensee encouraged it. It is concerning that licensee was aware of an agency employee working at agency supportive housing, performing duties to manage the home, and also providing behavioral health services at the home. Of further concern, licensee represented being unaware as to whether or not the supportive housing where behavioral health services were taking place was DHS licensed. Licensee represented the following. He does not know if supportive housing was licensed by the Department of Health Services. He did not verify this because he was relying on his partner to make sure it was in order. Despite providing clinical oversight, licensee failed to ensure employees were not providing unlawful services to clients through agency. In review of client's clinical record, there were several case management notes which outlined client's daily activities with a service code of T1016. Additionally, the case management notes contained durations ranging from 120 to 180 minutes. Licensee signed off on these case management notes, declaring them accurate and complete. It is unclear how documentation of a client's daily activities can be classified as case management services. Licensee represented the following. Licensee signed off on case management notes outlining a client's daily living because he believed there was a different silo of billing coming from a different revenue source than access. Licensee has misconstrued the idea of what case management is. It is also concerning that the progress notes and case management notes for client had a listed clinician who authored and signed the note but indicated a different individual as the facilitator of the documented services. Licensee represented the following. The electronic medical record system they utilized had limitations, and only licensee and one other clinician were authorized users. Licensee would receive notes via email or as hard copies. The individual who facilitated the service wrote the note. The authorized clinician then transcribed it into the system. Furthermore, the notes were documented in some instances approximately 3 months after the service was provided. Licensees then signed the progress note and case management notes approximately 12 days to a month after the note was created. Despite licensee initially representing he was only employed with agency until approximately 2 weeks following access suspension in 623, licensee signed documentation in 923. Upon review of provided clinical supervision notes by licensee, they ranged from 1/11/23 to 8/1/23. These dates predate the start of his documented employment with agency and extend past his initially represented end date. Furthermore, they extended past the date of agency's access suspension, at which point client services were no longer supposed to be provided. Upon review of the content, there were multiple clinical supervision notes that contained copy and paste information. Licensee represented the following. Licensee documented clinical supervision notes late. As he was trying to catch up, he must have inadvertently cut and pasted the wrong note. Licensee acknowledged this would also mean the date of his signature on the notes would be inaccurate as they were created at a later date. The provided clinical supervision notes are dated after 6/23 because they were for his engagement with his private practice team, and there was not a delineation between agency's notes and the work they did for other places. It is highly concerning that licensee is unable to distinguish with certainty at which facility the provided clinical supervision was for, and that he also backdated his signature on clinical supervision notes. A 3/7/23 clinical supervision note indicates that housing issues should be reported to leadership of the clinic and housing as they are integrated. Licensee's documentation of the integrated nature between housing and a clinic also brings into question his previously noted representation that he believed the two locations were separate with agency. Licensee's role as the clinical director was to provide clinical oversight for the provided services by unlicensed staff. However, there are a number of documented concerns regarding the quality of supervision. Additionally, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to R461103 client record. This recommendation is based on the following. In review of clients' clinical records, there were several documentation deficiencies noted. The consent forms were missing 7 required elements. A review of clients' progress notes showed there were notes signed approximately 3 months after the date the service took place. Not only were notes not contemporaneously signed, the listed clinician and author of the note was not the listed facilitator of the service. Licensee then reviewed and signed the notes despite this fact. Of further concern, licensee signed a 131 note modification policy, which gave agency permission to modify notes on behalf at their discretion. Additionally, client's treatment plan, although it noted client verbally agreed to it via telehealth, it does not contain the client's signature. Licensee represented the following. Client's treatment plan did not contain a signature because he believes it was through telehealth. They waited too long and it should have been done when he was in the clinic. It is concerning that licensee, who's been licensed with the board since 2012, was acting as the clinical director but failed to ensure consent forms met the board's minimum requirements. It's also concerning that licensee signed off on notes that were written and signed approximately 3 months after the services took place. And that is all I have unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carver. Any board members have questions for staff? Okay, there are no questions. So now it's time for the licensee and counsel to address the board. You have up to 6 minutes.
Thank you. If it may please the board, we just heard a lot of bullet point allegations with respect to 2 claimed professional deficiencies. The 2 deficiencies that are cited, you will hear from my client, the licensee, were essentially his attempt to try to be ethically compliant and serving his role as clinical director of the outpatient clinic. There's a number of information that was provided by the complainant who's not here to present their complaint, notably, that there was some overlap between an outpatient clinic and behavioral health or allegedly unlicensed housing. In this case, the licensee was an independent contractor for an outpatient clinic and had no oversight over any type of housing. However, there were some notes that dealt with issues that the patients were having in the housing that they brought into the clinic. And it was his perspective that the whole person is to be treated. And so having over 12 years of experience in the behavioral health field, with absolutely no board incidents or complaints against him, and that is something that you are requested to consider under these circumstances. The proposal in terms of impact on his license does seem a bit extreme, and so we are hoping that the board will consider, if not a dismissal, some type of finding with a stayed probationary period, perhaps some additional training, and being able to allow my client to continue to serve the public in the clinician role, which is his strong suit. Administrative, admittedly, had not been. And so, without taking additional time, from Mr. Udo Emma, I'm going to ask him to please present his side of the story and ask for clemency and grace on behalf of the board with respect to understanding that he had no dishonest or self-serving motive. He has cooperated with this entire investigation. There's been no bad faith or, you know, any type of refusal to acknowledge any room for improvement with respect to the role that he undertook, which was the first type of role of that nature versus working in a larger clinical setting. So, Mr. Udoema, please introduce yourself and answer any questions the board may have.
Board, good morning. My name is Iyang Ada Udoema. I'm a licensed professional counselor. Thank you for being able to hear me today. I provide a critical service to the public to be able to help them work through their emotional dysregulation, help them to be able to increase their health, happiness, and safety. This is something that I've been very passionate about throughout my entire career. I have been a diligent clinician working for larger agencies and then spreading out to try to assist and create some and engage agencies to help continue with that providing services. As I have reviewed the investigation and I look back on it, I see that there are choices I could have made differently, things I could have done to improve. I could have brought in some different services in for additional QM. I could have advocated more on the administrative side. I was there to be able to supervise and engage folks to help them overcome their emotional dysregulation and their substance use in the clinic. As far as housing is concerned, that was the purview of the ownership of the clinic, as I was a contracted through RISE to be able to be their clinical director and provide services. I do appreciate that and realize that it is my responsibility as the clinical director to have done more. And I do take the responsibility of that. And I would like the opportunity to be able to continue providing services to clients and to individuals. It's something that I'm very passionate about, and I believe I do a good job with it. I wholeheartedly open myself up to be retrained, to be updated, to be to move forward and continue to provide a service within the community. I would ask for that opportunity to correct and amend and to help move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any board members have any questions for the licensee? Okay, so there are no questions. So this will be time for us to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. I believe, Mr. Miller, you are leading the discussion.
Yes, thank you. I'm prepared to make a motion, but I would like to hear from board members because I'm struck with a number of serious concerns that this case kind of presented in the investigative report to the extent that a member passed away, as well as clinical oversight, supervision responsibilities, and then understanding of what a clinical director's duties are in a contracting capacity or in a full-time capacity. And so, you know, that being said, I would first like to make a motion to move for or to find for the violations stated in the record, but I would want to ask if there are any comments before I do so.
Well, if I may add, I think that, you know, I'm on board with that is the evidence is here.
Yeah.
Right. And I agree with you that it seems like the role of the clinical director at an agency was not fully understood. And also, you know, outpatient and a house, residential, whatever, do not overlap. They have different rules, expectations. And I think that those things were missed. Yeah, anybody else? I think I'm just saying the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. I motion to find for violations ARS 3232 5116K, inadequate clinical supervision, and ARS 3232516P, documentation deficiencies as it relates to AAC R461103 client record.
Do I have a second?
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. And recommendations?
Yeah, so I'd like to make a recommendation for consent agreement, but I think it should be very specific and strict, kind of given the violations and some of the concerns that were previously stated. So I was thinking 24 months with stipulations with regard to education, clinical supervision, and practice restriction. And I can go through those specifically for the record, but does anybody else have any recommendations for the consent agreement?
That's kind of what I had.
Okay.
Anybody have anything else or not in agreement?
All right. So I will repeat that back with specificity for the record. I'd like to make a motion to offer the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months with the following stipulations. Education, 3 hours in behavioral health ethics, 5 clock hours of attendance at an AZBBHE board meeting, and 3 hours in Arizona documentation. I'd also like to offer or require clinical supervision for 24 months, twice monthly, with the focus of behavioral health ethics, board statutes and rules, and Arizona documentation, with the stipulation that early release is allowable after 12 months upon the recommendation of the professional providing the clinical supervision. And finally, practice restriction with the specification that the licensee may not provide clinical supervision and the length upon recommendation of the clinical supervisor.
Go ahead.
Any questions?
I just wanted to clarify in regards to the practice restriction, part of our template for a consent agreement, anytime it's disciplinary during the time they're on the consent agreement, they cannot provide clinical supervision.
Thank you.
And may I also ask that you consider possibly as part of that clinical supervision DHS rules?
Yes, thank you. I would like to add that.
Maybe restrict private practice. It doesn't seem that that's what the licensee is doing, but just adding it as a caveat.
Is that a part of the would I have to add that?
You would need to add that, correct.
Okay. I would like to add restricting private practice during the consent agreement duration.
May I just have a discussion?
Yeah.
I welcome your input. So the private practice was not necessarily an issue. So I was just wondering about restricting private practice, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I necessarily agree with like restricting private practice, because it looks like his main form of job right now is through BetterHelp, which in a sense is private practice. I mean, it doesn't sound like he's out on his own, obviously providing like underneath his own business name. But it sounds like he's doing that through BetterHelp. And so I also don't know, I don't agree with it, because it sounds like the complaint has to do with something completely different, like supervision and things like that. And there's nothing mentioned in it about private practice.
Did you have a further thought on it?
But yeah, my thought was just that some of the concerns was understanding rules of, with ADHS and just, running your own practice, there's a lot of different rules to understand. And so that was just my thought is like, while you're on the consent agreement, learn what you're needing to do. But I do agree that private practice wasn't mentioned or wasn't the issue. I just thought that.
Well, I think maybe like with supervision, that might be like a good like thing to have that be like a focus of supervision is, learning how to, the rules of a private practice and having, updated consents and paperwork and documentation and everything like that. I think that that would be potentially extremely helpful in a way that we could help rehabilitate.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So can we add that to So the focus of supervision is coaching or mentoring and supervising private practice.
I agree with that. I think that takes care of it.
Yeah.
Instead mm-hmm. of restricting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think just that was kind of my intent of it is, you know, yeah. That's what you said.
Just with emphasis for that clinical supervision, I don't know if we have to put it, but on these different platforms, remember these are tech agencies, they're not clinical agencies. And so they think that they understand our statutes and laws, but they do not. So they may tell you, oh, you don't need a treatment plan. You're making sure that that clinical supervisor is providing definite oversight over documentation because it could become an issue with any of these platforms.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Due to the egregiousness of the evidence that you have, did you want to consider putting a state suspension?
I was considering that. I could move to add that if my colleagues agree. I was on the fence a little bit, but given the investigations with other departments and things like that, I did consider that.
Yep.
I would agree.
Yeah, so that's please. Part of the
and just for the record for the public and for the licensee and attorney, a stay suspension basically is part of the consent agreement, and as long as the licensee stays compliant with all the stipulations in the consent agreement, there will be no suspension. At any time, if he goes out of compliance, then the stay will be lifted and his license would be suspended. And this is very common for our board to do in these types of cases where they feel the level of egregiousness is there. So at this time, if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and read back what I have.
Yes, please.
Okay. So we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. There would be a state suspension. He would be required to complete 3 CEUs in behavioral health ethics, 5 CEUs in attending a board meeting, 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation. He also would be required to get clinical supervision twice monthly. The focus of that would be on behavioral health ethics, statutes and rules, DHS rules, Arizona documentation, as well as managing your own private practice. At the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, he could be released from that clinical supervision after 12 months. And if not signed, this matter would be remanded to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
That is my motion.
Do I have a second?
Grove, second.
Roll call, please.
Adelise Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Thank you. So this concludes the matter. And if you have additional questions, you can call your investigator. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Next item is item 7E, Carol Warner. Do I have the complainant? Give me 1 second. And is the licensee here too? Okay. So for first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff. And then you'll have an opportunity to address the board. Ms. Zavala?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the board, I just want to remind you there was a supplement to the report that was uploaded as well. Does not make a difference to the analysis, but just for your record. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16Y, engaging in any dual relationship with a client that could impair the licensee's objectivity or professional judgment or create a risk of harm to the client. For the purpose of this subdivision, dual relationship means a licensee simultaneously engages in both a professional and non-professional relationship with a client that is avoidable and non-incidental. This recommendation is based on the following. In 7 of 24, the board received a complaint against licensee alleging that complainant met licensee through church, then shortly after began a therapeutic relationship. Complainant alleged that he was introduced to licensee by a mutual friend through the church, and that a couple of days after his first session with licensee invited complainant to join her for Christmas dinner at a restaurant. From 12/17/23 to 1/5/24, licensee provided behavioral health services to complainant and diagnosed complainant with multiple diagnoses. Complainant's therapy focused on reconciling with wife, the church, and complainant's well-being.
Despite licensee documenting in a 12-17-23 note, it was not a session note. Licensee maintained this note within complainant's clinical records, making it appear this was meant to be a clinical session. A 12-22-23 note included the following in part. Because it was Christmas and because of complainant's great losses at the moment, licensee invited complainant to join her and priest for Christmas after dinner in public. Thought complainant would learn a lot from priest. This was a one-time thing and something priest and licensee could be charitable about because it was Christmas. Complainant and licensee will meet in the office only and not socially. Despite licensee documenting in a note that she would be attending a dinner with complainant, it is highly concerning that she documents they would only meet in the office and not socially, yet they in fact attended a social dinner together outside of the office. It is highly concerning that licensee felt it was appropriate for any reason to invite a client to a personal dinner with another colleague and consume alcohol with this client. Additionally, while licensee was complainant's active therapist, licensee received chiropractor services from complainant. A further concern, the 1-2-24 note outlines the following. Licensee lists an evaluation of risk management factors, which included the following. Licensee went initially to complainant's office for testing only. To complainant's surprise, wife was there. Complainant and licensee decided they should meet only in licensee's office at the appointed time. Complainant did not want wife knowing who this therapist was, given her irrational behavior, so he suggested bartering. This note clearly shows licensee became aware of risk with receiving chiropractor services with complainant, yet indicates the risk as wife's finding out rather than the risk being that licensee was engaging in a dual relationship with complainant. It is highly concerning that the licensee engaged in this dual relationship with complainant by simultaneously acting as a complainant's therapist while receiving chiropractor services from complainant, attending the same church, and having a social dinner together outside the therapy setting. Licensee represented the following during board staff's investigation. A significant portion of events took place within the context of the church community. Licensee saw complainant as a colleague who was important to come to the congregation. Licensee denied any romantic or sexual feelings towards complainant. Licensee and complainant did not have any sort of conversation and boundaries while they were simultaneously attending church at the same church while engaging in a therapeutic relationship. Licensee did not have contact with complainant when they saw each other at church. Licensee ran into complainant at a grocery store and they had a brief conversation where complainant was talking about wife. It appears licensee attempts to shift blame at times by indicating that complainant may be trying to protect his own license and pin things on licensee, and that wife may be playing a role in complainant's perspective on this complaint. It appears licensee also attempted to conceal the Christmas dinner gathering with complainant as evidenced by 1-14-24 texts where licensee acknowledges denying the dinner occurred when questioned by others. Even more concerning, complainant engaged in services with licensee to address issues within his marriage, then licensee engaged in inappropriate boundary crossing with complainant, causing complainant to feel this was an emotional affair he was having with licensee. Furthermore, licensee acknowledged providing behavioral health services to another woman in her church. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3261-16K, engaging any conduct or practices is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession as it relates to the following section of the NESW Code of Ethics, 1.13B, Payment for Services. This recommendation is based on the following. During the course of the board staff's investigation, it was found that licensee failed to maintain any sort of billing records for several services licensee provided to complainant. Upon further investigation, it was found that licensee was bartering services with complainant. For example, licensee represented that complainant would give licensee over-counter supplements and provided licensee one chiropractor service in exchange for therapy services. Licensee's informed consent does not include anything regarding bartering being an acceptable form of payment. Therefore, it is unclear how licensee developed this bartering agreement. Furthermore, the NASW Code of Ethics outlines that bartering should be avoided but could be acceptable if essential for the provision of services negotiated without coercion and entered into at the client's initiative and with the client's informed consent. Based on a 12-27-23 text message, licensee is the one to ask if the complainant could possibly trade services. Despite licensee representing that bartering was complainant's idea that was discussed verbally, licensee failed to document this verbal conversation, and based on a 12-27-23 text, licensee initiated the idea of bartering. Furthermore, licensee failed to demonstrate or document how this arrangement would not be detrimental to complainant or the professional relationship. Even more concerning that the licensee's documents in the 1-2-24 progress note that complainant suggested bartering, yet licensee's text message clearly shows she's suggesting the bartering. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be a violation of ARS 32-3251-16T, disclosing a professional confidence or privileged communication, except as may otherwise be required by law or permitted by a legally valid written release. This recommendation is based on the following. A 12-22-23 note indicated that licensee invited complainant for Christmas dinner, and it would be a one-time thing and something licensee and priest could be charitable about because it was Christmas. Licensee represented that she told priest about someone who was a despondent, and priest told licensee to invite this individual to Christmas dinner. Licensee informed priest that the individual she was going to invite was a client, but did not disclose further information. It is concerning that when asked whether licensee felt this was a breach of confidentiality, she represented the following. Licensee did not provide the client's name. Complainant accepted the invitation. Complainant told priest a lot of information and acknowledged to the priest he was a licensee's client. Despite licensee's representation that she did not provide complainant's name, licensee clearly told priest she was bringing a therapy client to dinner, and once they were together for dinner, priest and complainant interacted extensively. It is highly concerning that licensee fails to see this breach of confidentiality when, in fact, she is the one who told the priest she was bringing a client, making priest fully aware that the complainant was her therapy client. Whether complainant accepted the invite or priest said to invite someone to the dinner, these are not exceptions to the breach of confidentiality. Additionally, licensee shared details of the board complaint with priest and pastor. By providing information to them about this board complaint, the complaint clearly outlines the complainant was licensee's client. Licensee again breached confidentiality because she now made others aware that she was complainant's therapist, which is protected by HIPAA laws. Additionally, licensee asked priest to write a letter as a board defense so she could provide a fact witness statement attesting to the Christmas dinner. Even if licensee did not share details of complainant's services with others, the fact that she confirmed complainant was a client is a breach of confidentiality in itself. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be a violation of ARS 32-3261-E, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record, and financial and billing records. This recommendation is based on the following. At the onset of services, licensee failed to obtain any sort of signed informed consent for complainant indicating his consent to services. A 1-5-24 treatment plan for complainant failed to include three of the board's minimum requirements. All of complainant's progress notes failed to include two of the board's minimum requirements. And licensee represents she attempted to provide complainant with an informed consent but must have forgot to follow up on it. Licensee was not aware her progress notes and treatment plans failed to include various requirements. Licensee acknowledged having phone calls with complainant in one session on 12-29-23, but failed to document the interactions with complainant's clinical records. Despite licensee documenting at least four individual sessions with complainant, licensee failed to maintain any sort of billing records with complainant's clinical records. Licensee represented that services complainant were being bartered, yet her informed consent does not include that bartering is a form of payment for services. Even if licensee represents they were bartering services, a text message from 12-27-23, licensee asking for the first time whether they could barter services, meaning licensee had already began treating complainant before the idea of bartering came about. Licensee represents that other clients' clinical records would include signed consents, treatment plans, and billing records. It is highly concerning that licensee has been independently licensed with the board since 2008 and in private practice, yet fails to ensure her clinical documentation meets all of board's requirements. Furthermore, in 2018, 2020, 2022, and 2024, licensee completed license renewal applications, which required her to complete the board's tutorial regarding statutes and regulations, which specifically provided education and training on clinical documentation standards. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions? Okay, no questions. So, complainant, you now have up to 10 minutes to address the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In December of 2023, my wife and I of 40 years signed a temporary separation agreement to work on our marriage by getting counseling separately and together. My intention from this initial meeting with this counselor was to save my 40-year marriage. Looking back after the last 9 months of speaking with numerous counselors and attending 3 marriage intensives, it became clear that she was grooming me from the beginning to lead me into a dual relationship, which then led to an emotional affair, as she knew I was in a state of extreme vulnerability, weakness, and trauma. My primary motivation for being here today is to protect the public from experiencing the trauma that my wife and I have suffered as the result of seeking marital counseling with this counselor. I sought care from this counselor, trusting that she had my best interests in mind and that she would help me heal and restore my marriage. The journey since my first meeting with this counselor has been severely misguided, painful, and costly. Misguided in the fact that this counselor sought from the first encounter with me, knowing full well the nature of the turmoil I was faced with, to blatantly violate her duty of care by inviting me to Christmas dinner and a party where she knew where she should have been trying to lead me back to my wife. She picked me up in her car, drove me to the party, and then to dinner. Painful because of the betrayal trauma that my wife and I now suffers as a result of the extreme breach of the standard of care that was intentionally violated. This type of trauma my wife and I are faced with is extremely difficult to overcome and will have long-term consequences in our relationship. And if any of you have experience with betrayal trauma, you know that what I'm saying is true. And costly, as of now, this nightmare encounter with this counselor has cost me over $30,000 from attorney fees, because after my wife found out about the relationship with this counselor, she filed for a divorce. There were apartment rental fees, three marriage intensive programs, lost time at work, and numerous counselors. My first realization of how pathological this counselor's behavior was occurred during my first marriage intensive week. It was a five-day intensive sponsored by Focus on the Family in Branson, Missouri, where my wife and I spent 32 hours of counseling with a male and female counselor, all four of us in a room together. He was a PhD counselor who had many years of experience and maintained the utmost level of integrity and standard of care, who said this female counselor should never have agreed to accept me as a client for several reasons. First, because we attended the same church, and secondly, she should have referred me to a male counselor specializing in my specific issues. Over the last 9 months, I've spoken with no less than 14 counselors, all of whom have highly recommended I file this complaint, or they would if I didn't, since it was such a blatant breach of ethics. Several of those counselors stated that this probably is not the first time this kind of breach of care has occurred with this counselor. This has been emotionally taxing for both me and my wife, and as recommended by all counselors, we need to make every effort towards preventing this from happening to anyone in the future. The final indicator of just how wrong this counselor's intentions were occurred after she found out from her former friend that my wife had decided to rescind the divorce proceedings and tried to reconcile our marriage. Ms. Warner then called me and acknowledged that she knew my wife wanted to reconcile. She knew I still cared about my wife, and therefore we couldn't continue to see each other. That is not what a legitimate counselor would do with a couple who's trying to work things out. Once again, I want to thank you for listening to my complaint, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any board members have questions for the complainant? Thank you for your testimony. And now it's time for the board to deliberate. We ask that you... Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're free to go.
Okay.
Or go to the back. It's now the turn for the licensee to address the board after you introduce yourselves.
I'm Carol.
Ms. Stark.
I'm the licensee. I am Sarah Stark. I'm counsel for Ms. Warner.
Thank you. So you have up to 10 minutes to address the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to just briefly address Ms. Warner's perspective, and we fully understand and acknowledge that complainant has a different perspective of the situation, which highlights the risk of dual relationships. There is a power dynamic in the situation where the therapist, the professional, has a different standing in the relationship, and so that is why these relationships can be risky, because the client may understand things differently. While Ms. Warner perceived the situation one way, again, complainant viewed it completely differently. Ms. Warner vehemently denies any romantic, sexual, or even social motivations here. She naively saw this client as another provider and professional, and her intention was to connect practitioners on a professional level. Again, she had no intention to make any type of romantic or intimate advances towards complainant. Obviously, what ensued was unanticipated, and Ms. Warner ended the therapeutic relationship as soon as these issues became apparent. I also just wanted to highlight for the board that Ms. Warner has had a 40-year career here, and the period of time where these events were taking place was over a two-week period. You know, it is a mistake, a lapse in judgment that Ms. Warner made, but we would urge the board not to let this be a career-defining moment for her. You know, we would ask the board to consider looking at mitigation and remediation in this case. Ms. Warner is someone who has an understanding of her errors in judgment here and a willingness to put in work and additional education to prove that this brief situation does not define who she is as a practitioner and who she has been for the past 40 years. With that being said, I will turn it over to Ms. Warner to make some brief comments as well.
Yes, hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak here. There's several things, you know. We were in a church culture. This was, I believe, the complainant's first visit at this church after some time. So it's not like we had been, we knew each other before. We were introduced by a friend, and he asked to meet with me for a short while afterwards to discuss his wife had had asked him to find a female counselor because of the nature of his problem, that the male counselors were normalizing the issue he was dealing with. I'm not going to talk about what the issue was. And so I agreed to meet with him. On the 22nd of December is when we met. The client was despondent. The wife had, according to him, slandered him all over the church and to his friends, and that he didn't have anybody left. The priest, Brent Baum, is a licensed alcoholism counselor as well. He's developed a healing technique. He works with a lot of chiropractors. And so I thought the complainant would enjoy talking with him and learning from him. And mainly they talked, and I was set back. So one of the things that I was struggling with and thinking of is the church, the different church culture. And we have CEUs on cultural competency in different areas. But navigating the church culture has been extremely complex for a seasoned, even for a seasoned clinician as myself. And, you know, we were encouraged from the pulpit to invite those who were sad or alone or in despair to sacred holiday dinners. And so I would never do that again. But that's where I was coming from navigating the church culture. It's been my first time experience ever doing that with a client. He speaks of intentions. I had no negative intentions. I was not grooming him for anything. You know, we had three sessions. The one on 12/29, that was going to his office and getting x-rays. That was not a session. The treatment plan, it was not finished. That's why it wasn't signed or dated. It was almost finished, but in 2 weeks, it was a complex case anyway. And I would like to make good out of this situation by, I'm a good writer, by researching and developing, navigating the difficult church culture. You know, what do you do when, you know, when if you're seeing somebody, the complainant went to the church a few times and then stopped. He's a Catholic. He goes elsewhere. We sat apart, but I think that there's issues about navigating church culture that are probably that have come up here today in this very room. And how do you navigate the complexity of it when the church says do one thing and this says another thing. My intentions were innocent. It was a compassionate decision. He seemed to enjoy Brent. They seemed to enjoy each other. I would like to be able to do something to help clinicians navigate successfully and ethically a search culture, and I would research. I would pair up with somebody else to do that, but I would really like to do that to move it forward. The situation when complainant came to me was that the wife had kicked him out of the house, and she was slandering him, saying horrible, horrible things about him. The marriage was a horrible mess. And so I would like to, I'd just like to say that I want to move forward on a positive and turn this into an educational experience, not for my, just for myself, but for others. I have not seen any writings on navigating for a therapist to church culture and the different messages. So I, you know, I would see that as part of cultural competence. And obviously I fell short in that. And I, you know, after 40 years, no, with no complaints, you know, I struggled with it. I discontinued the session when I heard from my ex-friend that, you know, Daniel was going to.
I'm sorry. Okay. Initials. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. What's that? I'm sorry. Initials. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. When I heard that the wife wanted to get back with him, and the wife accused me of, you know, she was saying, they had been saying, slandering, saying that we were having sex therapy and having sex. That was the slander that was going around the church. You can't. And so at first I lied about the Christmas dinner, and I apologized right away to her because I don't want to lie about anything to anybody. And I apologized to her right away. I did not lie to the pastor, which is somebody, the reference was that I lied to others. No, I just lied to her, and I immediately apologized and repented. I told the pastor that I had lied to her, but I knew all along that the pastor knew about the Christmas dinner. There's no way I was going to lie about it. You know, Daniel told me he knew, and I was glad the pastor knew. That provided a kind of safety to me. Anyway, I humbly asked the board to consider accepting my plan of mediation along with whatever you want, because I do think that there's little to no information about navigating church culture for a therapist. And there's a lot of issues. Sarah and I have talked about a lot of them. I would like the opportunity to research and develop that.
Right. Thank you. Yes. Ms. Zavala?
Madam Chair, I just want to bring your attention to something just because I think that we need some clarity on something. Thank you, Mr. Carver, for pointing it out to me. What number? In the interview with the licensee, licensee represents that she's currently providing services to a woman at her church who was referred to her from a friend and indicated they stay apart from each other at church. So I just thought that was interesting because I think the comment was made that she's never done this before, and she's acknowledged that she has.
Thank you.
May I speak to
you? Hold on just a second.
Yeah, so to clarify, that was after the situation with complainant. So when we say it was the first time with complainant, that was the first situation.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the licensee or counsel?
Yes, I have several.
Okay, Ms. Palacios.
Yes, my first question, Ms. Warner, is how in the future would you separate your ministry or your church culture from your clinical practice?
So that's what I want to research and develop. However, if I see people at the church, like I am now, and we're wrapping up with that, we sit in different places. We don't interact, you know, other than to say hello if we're passing, just meeting me in the office, and that's all.
And my second question for you is, what is your ethical decision-making model, or what is your ethical decision-making model when you decide to take on clients that are in church with you? What model do you use to decide ethically if that is appropriate?
I don't know what you mean by ethical decision model with the complainant. You know, we talked for a little while, and I decided I could take him on. The other person, I did not know. She was referred to me, and there was enough separation and distance that, you know, that it seemed like the issue that she was dealing with, I could help her with. And you know, we stay far apart at church.
And Ms. Palacios, if I may, maybe you could explain what the decision-making process would be going forward, mm-hmm. other than what's already happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, the decision-making process would look like I would look very carefully, you know, at whether that is possible. I have a waiting list of clients. I don't need to accept church clients, so I do not want to repeat of anything that happened. I want to, you know, I learn from it. I, you know, would never do the dinner again, even though that's the church model of compassion. I won't do that. The dual relationship issue, the bartering, that was brought up initially when I went to the complainant's office. And he suggested it because we had exchanged Medicare cards. We were going to do Medicare. And the wife found out, and he did not want her in his records. And so he suggested at that point bartering. I followed up a few days later after researching it and saying that there are some situations that are for the well-being of the client, that bartering, this one seemed one of those situations. I've not bartered before. I will not barter again moving forward.
Yeah, thank you.
I do have a question. In your 40-year career, have you treated complex cases?
I work a great deal with dissociative identity disorder. Yes, I've had a lot of supervision and training in it.
Okay, because you said this one was particularly complex.
Well, it was complex in a different way.
Without going into specific diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's complex in a very different way. There was the church culture. And then this and everything that was going on, you know that my clinical, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have, but I've lost track of the question.
That's all right. I think you answered it. Did you consult with anybody when you felt like, oh, this seems different than other cases?
It was 2 weeks.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions for the licensing?
Yes.
Dr. Hennigan.
So currently, how many church clients are you seeing?
One.
Just the one.
Right. When we're wrapping up, I think.
And then just out of curious, how large is your congregation where you attend church?
I couldn't hear you. Sorry.
How large is the congregation where you attend church?
I'm not good at judging numbers, but I'd say between 150 and 200, depending on the week.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like we've kind of covered this, but I don't think I have the answer that helps me feel comfortable. You keep referencing church culture, yet in the context of the services you provide, ethics, boundaries, relationships. What I'm hearing is that you don't feel that the rules, the laws, everything that you are trained in apply when you put the context church culture around it to address that.
That's not true. I want to research how to navigate it with those ethics. Like I said, no, I'm not trying to say these supersede, but for somebody wandering into this, it is a little confusing in navigating it. The dinner is a good example of that because we're encouraged to do that. You know, I feel very sad that the complainant thought I had ulterior motives. It was only to get him through a really rough day, right? And have him be able to speak with another colleague. He seemed very interested. No, I think that the ethics do apply, and that's why I would like to research it and do some kind of a module on it that's in line with ethics and how to navigate those things.
All right. No further questions? All right, so this is the time for board to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. Ms. Palacios?
Yes. So this is, it's really messy. And, you know, I know there's several of us that have ministry backgrounds, and separating your ministry or your church from your therapy practice is so important because you see how sticky and tricky it gets. And the boundaries are very different, and it's not a priest or a pastor or a rabbi or a bishop or anybody's responsibility to understand those boundaries. And they may make requests, oh, you're a professional, you have the skill, can you help this person?
But that's that they don't know any better. They don't carry the license. As licensees, it's our responsibility to hold and carry our ethics and our boundaries, and also your church or congregation should also be a safe place for yourself, right? And so when you start providing services or counseling to folks in your congregation, it no longer can feel that way, depending again on Dr. Hennigan's question, how big your congregation is. And so it seems like a very clear cut line is that needs to be your safe space and not your place where you're also having business or getting business, having a clear, referral. Okay, I know this person. And if you're wanting, a client is wanting a background of ministry, then, I know this other counselor at a different church that I can potentially refer to, but not you yourself or a licensee themselves. Let's see. Yeah. So I'm just trying to catch all my notes here on this, but yeah, it is the licensee's responsibility to hold the boundaries. Then I had asked about the ethical decision making tree and consultation as well, as that's so important as if we encounter a client or an inquiry and we're not sure about it, of seeking consultation from others and using that ethical decision tree making model to protect the client, first of all, and then also ourselves. So those are kind of my comments. I am prepared to make a motion, but also want to open it up. And there's, again, other things there as in a ministry, a church setting. Yes, we, can be called to help somebody in need. But if you're their therapist, it's sticky. It gets messy. You can't have dinner with somebody that you're providing therapy to. And so, yes, if church is your safe space, then maybe you can do that because you're not in a professional relationship with that power dynamic and differential. So those are my comments. Would love to hear from other colleagues.
I think I also wanted to comment on the perceived power differential, because even though our intention may be one thing when we're working with a client who tends to be vulnerable, their perception of what's happening can be very different. And I think that was one of the concerns mm-hmm. for me, is that I know it can become he said, she said, but for us, our mandate is to protect the client and to be aware of what's happening in that perception.
Yeah.
And, today we heard about, how that has impacted, the complainant, client, and his family, right? So it is, like Ms. Palacios said, it's our responsibility to know, right, and to make sure to do everything we can to not appear to be allowing things or say, well, the client said it's okay, right? But we should know that it's not.
It's our responsibility to make that call, not leaving it up to the client, because they don't know what our ethics and our boundaries are, and they're not held to that same standard that we are as a licensed professional.
Any other comment?
I do have one.
Yes, sure.
And the other concerning thing for me is just the lack of consultation. Mm-hmm. When we get in those situations where we are thinking this might be sticky, we should immediately be consulting with our colleagues. What would you do in the same situation? And nowhere in any of the report or anything that Ms. Warner stated, was there any point where she was reaching out to her colleagues to determine what standard practice is in our field?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct.
Yeah. I have one more comment too. As what you said, we're the stewards of our license and in our ethics. And if the church is a safe place for a person, that's their coping skill, now it's tainted. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be careful we're not tainting coping skill or a safe place for not just for us, but for the
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Ms. Palacios.
Yeah, so I'm prepared to make a motion to open complaint, offer consent agreement for ARS 32325116Y dual relationships. Bartering of services, ARS 32325116K, 1.13B, payment for services. Oops, I went too fast. Okay, breach of confidentiality, ARS 32325116T.
And then documentation deficiencies, ARS 3231516P.
Do I have a second?
Grove, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. And recommendations?
Yeah, some of my thoughts for the consent agreement initially is Arizona documentation, a grad class on ethics and boundaries with a focus on dual relationships, a class on self-care as well, three CEUs on self-care, and a three CEU course on HIPAA. And those are my thoughts. I'm open to hear others.
Can I add another CE course? I'd like to see something on high conflict couples and families, because it kind of sounds like that was something that was a little nerve-wracking. So I think that, you know, in order to rehabilitate and avoid this in the future, that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
And so the consent agreement is 24 months. Is that okay?
Madam Chair, if we're only going to be doing education, it would only be for 12 months.
I was going to add.
Okay, sorry. I apologize.
That's okay. I would like to add supervision, maybe twice a month. I think that, you know, with all these years of practice and seeing all of this, you know, I think that that would be helpful, right, to kind of discuss rules and laws and documentation and ethics in a supervision setting versus just like the class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been in agreement with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you thinking for the two years or first year and then after the first year, the discretion of the supervisor?
I think I'd like that. The 12 months or and then
yeah,
the discretion of the supervisor. The other thing that I was wondering is maybe a graduate level course, right?
Mm-hmm.
In ethics,
yeah,
versus the three CEUs.
Yeah, I had stated the graduate level.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I missed that.
Could be a graduate level course on Christian ethics.
Yeah,
I was emphasis on, yeah, you know, the dichotomy of the two. So
mm-hmm,
maybe Christian ethics too, because it's going to address some of those boundaries.
Yeah,
Dr. Like Dr. Hennigan, would that address some of the issues that we heard today about the complexities
it
of
could,
navigating that?
Yeah, because you know it intersects with, you know, quote unquote secular, and then what's your role here and what's your role here and mm-hmm, bigger
relationships.
I like that.
Things, mm-hmm.
Yeah, relationships.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I would encourage you to consider doing a graduate level course in behavioral health ethics and then doing the Christian piece of it within that clinical supervision.
Okay.
Based on our roles.
Yeah. And a right, clinical supervisor that is culturally competent in that area.
Mm-hmm. Do we have everything?
Yeah, I think so.
Supervision.
Yeah, supervision, ethics.
Should we put the revocation and the restriction of supervising?
We always have a restriction of providing clinical supervision, and I don't believe that the licensee provides clinical supervision.
I do not.
Okay. Thank you.
So if I can read this back. If I could read this back to you, we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. She would be required to take three CEUs in Arizona documentation, a graduate level course in behavioral health ethics, three CEUs in HIPAA, three CEUs in self-care, three CEUs in high conflict cases with couples and families. She'd also be required to get clinical supervision twice monthly. The focus on clinical supervision would be behavioral health ethics, Arizona documentation, Christian ministry in working with clients, self-care, statutes and rules, high conflict couples and families, and HIPAA. And after the first 12 months, after the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, she could be released from clinical supervision. If not signed, invited for a formal interview. If not accepted, remand to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
I'd also like to add attend a board meeting.
So
and then that would be my motion.
So we'll modify that motion to five CEUs of attending a board meeting.
Yes, that's correct. That is my motion.
Miller, second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
And just for the record, before we go on break, I just want to make a note to people listening and supervisors that when you take a licensee under a consent, that you read the consent clearly and that your supervision notes and meetings reflect that you are actually addressing what's on the consent. That would be extremely helpful. Thank you. And now we're going to go on a break at 10:40, 10-minute break. The board meeting is back in session at 10:55, and we're moving to agenda item 7A, Janice Allen. Is the complainant here? You're the complainant? Okay. You can come to sit at the front. And is the licensee here? Okay. All right. So first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-1351-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession, and or ARS 32-3251-16CC, failing to take reasonable steps to inform potential victims and appropriate authorities if the licensee becomes aware during the course of providing behavioral health services that a client's condition indicates a clear and imminent danger to the client or others. This recommendation is based on the following. In 3 of 24, licensee provided one psychotherapy service to client who was a minor at the time. A 3/15/24 intake assessment with client included the following. Licensee marked yes for suicide ideation and client reported suicide thoughts about once per week. Licensee marked yes to suicide attempts and client reported taking pills 2 weeks prior, but no medical attention was needed. Licensee and client worked on a safety plan and client convincingly denied suicidal plans. A 3/14/24 chart note included the following. Client reported suicidal thoughts and attempt in the past couple of weeks. Client did not tell her parents, but she has talked to her friends about it. Client convincingly denied having a plan to repeat an attempt. Client reported she would talk with friends if or when if she is having suicidal thoughts again. They began safety planning and client reported feeling safe upon leaving the session. A 3/25/24 individual supervision note included the following. Staffed a new 15-year-old client who had a previous suicide attempt 2 weeks prior. Client took ibuprofen, no medical attention was needed, and she did tell her friends about it. Client does not want to tell her parents and client denied current suicidal ideation. Supervisor informed licensee she needed to tell the parents and advised to do so at the client's next appointment. A 3/28/24 chart note included the following. Complainant informed licensee that client was currently in the hospital for trying to overdose and take her life. Licensee confirmed with complainant that client has told licensee about her previous attempt. Licensee informed complainant that client reported she would tell her friends or father if she had further suicide ideation. Client told complainant that client reported she felt safe and denied suicidal plans. A 4/3/24 individual supervision note included the following. Followed up on client and reviewed the necessity of reporting suicide ideation and previous attempts to the parents. Licensee and supervisor will engage in further supervision regarding these topics. Licensee is to take trainings on suicide and mandated reporting. Licensee represented the following during her investigative interview. During the intake, client disclosed a previous suicide attempt by taking ibuprofen. Licensee did not feel client was hiding her attempt since client reported telling her friends. Client reported having suicidal thoughts about once a week but denied having the means or intent. Licensee did not clarify whether client still had access to ibuprofen. Licensee did not feel there was a threat that client would attempt suicide again, so she did not conduct a more in-depth risk assessment. Licensee began safety planning with client but did not complete the safety plan form agency utilizes. Prior to client, licensee did not have any training or experience in creating safety plans or conducting risk assessments. If licensee had a similar situation now, she would immediately staff it with her supervisor. Even though licensee represents she did not have adequate training or experience in completing safety plans or risk assessments, it is concerning licensee failed to immediately notify the parents of a minor child or supervisor when client reported a recent suicide attempt. Furthermore, even though licensee reported that client report not having the means or intent, licensee acknowledged that client was experiencing suicidal thoughts weekly. Even more concerning is that the licensee represents she began developing a safety plan, yet client's clinical records fails to include any sort of safety plan or risk assessment. Licensee, in fact, failed to notify the parents of a minor client experiencing suicide ideation and a recent suicide attempt. Despite licensee planning to notify the parents of a client's recent suicide attempt at client's next session, client attempted suicide again before her next session occurred. Additionally, complainant only became aware of client's first suicide attempt after client attempted suicide a second time and was admitted to the hospital for the second suicide attempt. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for staff? No questions? Okay, so the complainant, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. You can introduce yourself.
Hello. Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's good.
My name's Nicole, and this is regarding my daughter. She was 14 at the time. I had started her in therapy regarding bullying issues she was going through in high school. We were aware of how depressed she was and how upset she was, but not to the fact that she was going to try to take her own life. She had one session in therapy, and then the following week after that, she attempted to take her life. She was admitted to the hospital and in ICU for 3 days, and thankfully, she did make it through, and she was able to share her story. And I asked her, why didn't you tell us about that you were feeling like you were going to do this? And why didn't you tell anybody? And she said, well, I told my therapist, and I told my friends. So I immediately, in the hospital, I had a message through the therapy portal. The therapist stating, like, I needed a phone call. What was going on? This is what I was told. And she did immediately call me back and was apologetic and said that she did make the wrong decision and she should have reached out to me, you know, or her father regarding this news that she knew about the past attempt, which we knew nothing about. And even her own siblings didn't know about it. You know, at that time I was in shock. She suggested maybe she should do an IOP program. And I'm like, she's in ICU right now. I can't even talk about this. It's like, thank God she was even alive to tell me this, or would I have ever not known? I don't know. It could have been prevented. She's a mandated reporter. And when I met with the social worker, the doctors, the nurses, they were like, what therapist doesn't report this to a parent? That is their job, 100%. And I was just in shock that all this had even happened to this extent. You know, she's my youngest of three. So think, I've already gone through two teenagers. I have a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old. I know what goes on with teenagers. This threw me for, I was just in shock. I don't know. She's doing well now. We put her in with a new therapist right when she was released. She's been with her consistently. I go to every single session with her. We've never had a gap in the last 6 months. And that therapist updates me on everything. And she also was like, she needs to be turned in for this incident that happened. I'm just thankful she's alive and that she's been given a second chance and she's doing really well right now. And she's been cleared to go back to school and she's happy. And, you know, bullying is a big thing in school right now. And I didn't realize how deep it was getting for her. And I'm like, how did you even know to do that with ibuprofen? I don't even know, like, who taught you that? But yeah, she was in ICU for 3 days regarding an incident that I guess could have been prevented if there was communication prior to that. There was no communication. I did reach out to the therapist's supervisor to let her know about it, you know, when we got home. And she said, I have been made aware of it. She's under additional supervision now. they never reached out to me themselves. I don't know. I just feel like that's just a simple thing that could have been shared with me with a phone call or an email. Like, just be aware. This is, be on the lookout for this is a thought in her mind. So, yeah, that's really all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that. Yeah. Any questions for the complainant? Okay, no questions. So you can go back to your seat.
Thank you.
And the licensee can come to the front. Ms. Allen, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Could you turn your mic on, please? That work? There we go. Thank you. It was towards the end of the session that the client mentioned that she had suicidal thoughts once a week. And then she did tell me about the attempt. She had mentioned that she had told friends. And with the balance of confidentiality and trying to gain rapport with a teenager, she was pretty adamant that she did not want mom to know. So we began a safety plan, and I asked her to tell friends or dad if the suicidal ideation got worse. It was my understanding that before the second attempt, she did contact dad, but he was unavailable to answer her. I think it was a text. I apologize that we did not reach out to a client's mom and let her know the steps that we've taken to improve the disconnect there. I have upped my supervision from 2 times a month to 3 times a month. I have taken CE courses on suicidality as well as ethics and ethical dilemmas, and I have completed those. And as a result, I have further had an occasion where, a similar occasion where I did use the things that I've learned to not repeat the same disconnect and did contact a mother in session. Thank you.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for Ms. Allen?
Yeah, my question for you is how now, after taking those CEUs, what is your understanding of involving parents when youth are presenting with suicidal ideation?
That is absolutely a necessity. It's not something to take lightly. And as I mentioned with this last case, it would have happened almost a year ago, the attempt, but I still felt it was necessary to call mom in and let know and just open those doors of communication between mom and daughter that this has been a concern. And so absolutely, I would err on the side of caution and include parents in any future communications.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Once you found out she was in ICU, did you do any coordination of care with the hospital prior to her discharge, or if they allowed, did you get any like paperwork, collateral paperwork to kind of help with?
No. When client's mother told me, as she mentioned, I informed that the IOP might be a better step for her daughter, but I didn't have any communication with any of the hospital staff.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other question?
I have a question. There's a
Mr. Madera.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. There's a question about the next appointment, because when I was looking over this whole thing, it kept saying at the next appointment she's going to talk to the parent. Was there already a scheduled appointment after the 24th?
It was scheduled. I apologize, I don't remember the date, but when I talked to my supervisor a few days later, it was scheduled, I think, for the following week. But in the meantime, the appointment was canceled. And so there was no second appointment.
Okay. Why was it decided between you and your clinical supervisor to wait for the next appointment and not that same day?
Because it was 3 days away, and upon clients, when she was leaving, she assured several times that she felt safe and had no plans to do another attempt.
What screening tools would you use, or do you use to kind of figure out suicidality?
You know what? Since this experience, my supervisor has provided me with several screening tools. She gave me about 4 or 5 of them. I don't know the exact names of the assessments, but I have gone through them and began using one in a different situation. But I absolutely have access, thanks to my supervisor and the clinical director, to more efficient and appropriate suicide assessments.
Right. No further. Yes, go
I
ahead.
I do have a couple questions. People are on your caseload?
I work part-time, so I probably have about 20, okay. 20 to 25.
And do you see 20 a week?
Oh, no. Probably 8 to 10 a week, maybe 12 at the most.
Okay. And then what is, over the next year or so, what is your plan in terms of practice?
I'm actually would like to lean more towards couple therapy, and I'm taking some courses right now for that.
Do you plan on staying at the agency that you're currently at?
Yes.
And then my last question was, is this client presented with recent suicidal ideation, and what was your decision-making process on waiting until your next supervision versus seeking out supervision immediately
right away
with your supervisor?
I suppose since client said she felt safe, like I mentioned, I asked her several times. She told me she would acknowledge that she would tell friends or dad. I did not properly assume the value of the risk. And so I thought I was okay to wait.
I have another question.
Okay, Mr. Madera.
Crystal kind of sparked another one. What's the discussion of the like informed consent process with your minors that you work with in regards to the work with the parents?
The informed consent is actually completed by the front office, so I have not very much to
You
do
should do that.
Well, the parent does come in for the first 10 or 15 minutes when I first meet with the client.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also had additional training on what is appropriate to talk with the parent client as far as suicide ideation, as well as drug use, risky behaviors, and what I will or not report to the parent. And so that is included in my parent assessment when parent and child assessment when they've come in together.
Okay. That's it.
All right. No. Oh, okay.
Quick one.
Yeah. Mr. Charles?
Yeah, as a public member, this is an area that I am very sensitive to. I rely on my professional colleagues heavily. But when it comes to issue where child's life was, unfortunately, he did had to commit suicide. And one of the things you said is that you were establishing rapport and you leaned more heavily on that. Mm-hmm. I want to hear you kind of walk me through a little bit on now how you would do this differently, because when it comes to if it were me or my child, my daughter, and you leaned on building rapport over protecting my child, I would have massive problems with that. So I think that maybe you've learned some things through this. Can you help me understand and walk me through how this will never happen again?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned, I did have an additional case where the child came in, and I had seen her a few times, maybe 3 or 4 times. And then she did say that she had some a suicide attempt several months ago, up to a year ago, I believe. And I'm like, I feel like, I feel like that's something we need to tell mom. And she was hesitant, you know, she didn't want to worry mom, didn't want to make concern with mom. And I'm like, I'm happy to be here with you. We can do it together. It's just something that we really need to tell her. And so we invited mom in, and I let client tell her about it, and we discussed it. And like you said, mom was very grateful to know. And so absolutely moving forward, I have learned the importance, you know, gaining rapport with a teenager is important, but certainly not at the risk of their life. And so I have learned that reporting and at the risk of not being, you know, at the risk of losing the client is more important than trying to be a friend.
Do you go over the limits of confidentiality as well, so that way the teens know, the parents know what that limit of confidentiality is?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. I said limit of confidentiality is if you're going to hurt yourself or hurt others, then I have a duty to report.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I thought that meant in the future. Duty, you're going to hurt yourself. With the client only meeting her once and with her assurances that she felt safe and was not going to attempt again, I thought I did not need to alert parents.
And you did use the word, if I heard correctly, friend. We aren't our clients' friends. So
thank you.
Yeah.
One more question. Sorry. Why wasn't the safety plan completed at the session?
Well, like I said, sessions are 15 minutes. The first 10 or 15 minutes are with mom, and it was at the very last 10 or so minutes of the session that client told me that that's about the attempt. Sure. And so in the matter means of time. But as I mentioned, you know, I had thought that we had made a safety plan, not extensive, but enough that she would tell somebody if she had that attempt again.
All right, no further questions. Mr. Madera, you're leading the discussion. We're going to deliberate. I'm sorry, we ask that you not interrupt.
Yeah, so I went back and forth because I know she's an LAC, but in regards to what to do, but we'll start with just finding the violations. Can I start with that?
Yeah,
I'd like to find it for both.
Okay.
Oh,
go ahead.
Do you want to have the discussion first?
Nobody has any additional.
Sorry, I'm assuming no one did. So we're good.
Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. For ARS 32-3251-16L and CC. And I guess I'd like to have a consent agreement.
Do I have a motion?
Oh, sorry.
That's the first.
That's the motion. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Bob Charles.
Aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Motion carries. Back to you, Mr. Madera.
Well, I'd like a consent agreement. I just don't know what to do at this point. I really struggled. Woke up in the middle of the night thinking about this case because it was mine to present, and I didn't know where to go. And so I kind of like to see what my colleagues are thinking in regards to, she is under supervision, question a little bit about the supervision in regards to not asking them to do it by the end of the day or immediately to report any of these things. So I don't know if I personally feel comfortable that the clinical supervisor that she currently has is suitable.
I would agree with that. You know, I feel the same way. Like I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about this case quite a bit as well. I am concerned about like the clinical supervisor's judgment, and why we waited. Because when we are treating minors, especially when we're looking at suicidal ideation, and duty to report, it looks a lot different than if we were seeing somebody who is an adult, right? Typically, we wouldn't involve a parent or a guardian or something like that in an adult. Maybe we might use some collateral if the client is okay with it. But when we're looking at a minor, it's much different. The parent is in charge of that child's care and safety. So we want to make sure that we are including them. So I'm concerned about the supervisor's judgment when it comes to providing supervision on this issue.
Okay, so we could probably parenthesis for that?
Yes.
For now?
Yeah.
And then, you know, as far as supervision, definitely I think that needs to be in place. Specifically for these issues like ethics and safety plan writing and crisis intervention, assessing for suicidality, part of the supervision. Probably, how would this, because I'm thinking 24 months, right? Maybe two times a month for the first 12 months.
Mm-hmm. I would like to see it four times a month. Like this is concerning, right? Somebody's life potentially could have been lost, right, in this situation. So I would probably say four times a month, at least for the first year.
First 12 months. Okay. And then after that?
I would say, what do you guys think, about twice a month or
by supervisor's
discretion? At the discretion of the supervisor. Yeah.
We could actually say at the discretion of the supervisor, no less than.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So no less than
twice a month.
Twice a month. Yep. Okay.
And we're specific. It's not the current supervisor. We want a different supervisor, right? Clinical supervisor, not the one she has now.
I would prefer that.
Yeah.
Ditto. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That making sense, Ms. Zavala?
Yes.
Okay. And
what I'd like to see something on care coordination, because if they're in the ICU and you're the treating therapist, you need to know what's just so much more you need to know. I mean, they're in ICU. What's the aftercare plan? How do you if they're going to IOP or PHP, what's your role after that? And you're coordinating care all the way through the process till they step back down to you. So, and the importance of checking in and things like that. The full integration of that.
Yeah, maybe that's something that we add to like a focus of supervision, like coordination of care, high risk mm-hmm. clients specifically.
Can I say something about the supervision? So if she has an outside supervisor that she's seeing weekly, in addition to, I'm certain that her agency is also going to require that she's obtaining supervision through the agency. We're potentially talking about supervision 6 to 7 times a month. And so just that's something I just want to throw out to consider.
To be honest with you, my thoughts about what's going on with the clinical supervisor and her actions are potentially opening up a complaint against the clinical supervisor or the clinical supervisor's actions.
So let me ask you a question. Are you working with an agency licensed through Department of Health Services? Okay. And there's other people there that could do the supervision?
I believe so.
So, I mean, you know, it's like we can order, you know, or propose, right, this kind of things on her consent agreement, and is, I guess, up to the licensee to meet those establish expectations.
Okay. One other thing I believe that Ms. Allen has taken a suicide prevention. I don't know if it was in person or not, but I would like to see her go through an in-person suicide prevention.
Can we be specific? Can I say the ASSIST training? The ASSIST training? There's a that training. Yeah. This is a 2-day one. Yeah. I want that.
And maybe even CEUs on working with you and I'm trying to wrap this, but I don't know, working with youth and limits of confidentiality and things of that nature. Or
I'd actually like to see, because even though she's mentioned that it sounds like she's going to be moving forward with kind of looking at treating couples, things come up when you're treating couples and families with parenting and things that are going on with their children as well. So I'd almost say I'd want something a little bit more like a graduate level course on like children and families and navigating treatment of that. What do you guys think?
I had thought, I don't know if I would go graduate level. My thinking was the ethics of working with families, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you know if the ASSIST training addresses suicidality in youth?
I think they have a specific one too, but
yeah, it does. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess the last thing that Ms. Allen said that struck me was she didn't do the safety plan because it was at the end of the appointment and it was like at the end of the session. And I guess just on record, that doesn't matter if they're grabbing that, you know, handle to get out and they tell you that your next appointment is going to start late. Period. It doesn't really, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone says that to you, your next client might be mad at you, but, or you have to go pick up your kids, you know, that's just the unfortunate part of the situation is that life doesn't always go as planned. So if someone says something like that and you're at the end of your session, you need to address it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that's not anything that we could probably put in a class, but I guess maybe I'm just saying that for all to know.
I think if you take a class on suicide prevention and risk, you know, and crisis.
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah.
Right. And I think especially when working with an agency and multiple people just shooting an email, hey, I'm in crisis, can someone go check in with my next client?
Right.
Can be appropriate when you have that agency support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. or even just letting your clients know if you have back-to-backs that there might be a problem. There might, if I'm late, it's because I'm dealing with the client, not because I'm, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think those are just common things that we all deal with time management. Mm-hmm. I'm a talker, so I'm often late,
yeah.
Not because of suicidality, but.
So do we have everything, Ms. Zavala?
I mean, I believe so. I just wanted to clarify the education, because it got, I think, kind of intermingled with the clinical supervision. So I want to make sure I got it straight.
Okay.
3 CEUs and suicide ideation, and then the 2-day assist training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the clinical supervision.
And something working with high conflict or
you want
high,
that you want children. You want that with the clinical supervision or a separate?
I think I'd like a CEU on working with children, families, and adolescents.
That's what I was thinking. The ethics of working with families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So what I have is we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. She'd be required to take 3 CEUs in working with families, 3 CEUs in suicide ideation. She would also be required to attend the assist 2-day training. She also be required for the first 12 months to get weekly supervision. That weekly supervision is the focus is going to be on behavioral health ethics, safety planning and risk assessment, crisis intervention, Arizona statutes and rules, coordination of care, working with families in crisis, and limit of confidentiality. After 12 months, at the recommendation of the supervisor, the amount per month can be lessened, but no less than twice monthly. And if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
I have a question. Do we need the CEs for suicide ideation when she's going to take assist? Is an assist addressing that?
I think I'm just being specific of what training I want. So that would be the assist training.
Yeah.
So it's not two different
things.
Just
so in that motion,
it's just the assist.
We'll take out the 3 CEUs and ideas.
Yes. Suicide ideation. Yeah.
Okay. And is that your motion?
Yes.
Hennigan second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Okay, thank you. So that concludes this case for you. And if you have any additional questions, you can contact your investigator. And again, for those listening that are going to be supervisors, please make sure that you read the consent agreement and that you address those items in there in your supervision meetings.
We want to address, I know that Mr. Madera and Ms. Groves brought up the clinical supervisor. Did we want to address that on considering opening a complaint?
Yes, absolutely.
So just recommending to open a complaint on the supervisor?
We need a motion.
Okay.
Okay. I make a motion to open up a complaint on the clinical supervisor. Do you want me to say the name?
You can. Allison
Ducott.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next item is 7F, Leslie Whiting. Do we have the complainant here? No complainant. Is the licensee here? Okay, you can come to the front. Is the microphone on there? Okay, thank you. So first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff.
Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation, ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to the recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession, as it relates to the following section of the ACA Code of Ethics, A8, multiple clients. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 8/17, licensee has been providing behavioral health services to client through a private practice. During the course of therapy, licensee involved multiple members of client's family. On 3/2/22, licensee held a session where client and son were both present and discussed Sun's starting counseling himself, and licensee provided recommendations for counselors. On 4-6-23, licensee held a joint session with client and wife involved in the session. On 10-19-23, licensee drafted a progress note which included the following in part. Session began with client and daughter. Client stated he wanted a better relationship with daughter. Licensee asked if daughter would rather talk alone, and she said yes. About 10 minutes into the session, licensee asked client to leave the room so she could talk to daughter. After client left the room, licensee told daughter she understood that she did not want to be here today and reassured daughter at this time that she would not have to come back to therapy again if she did not want to, and since she was here today, maybe they could talk about ways to improve her relationship with client. Daughter stated she did not know she was coming here until they drove up. Licensee, in fact, involved three of client's family members in his therapy without any sort of documentation attesting to their involvement in the therapy. Furthermore, licensee failed to document the rationale or each participant's role in client's therapy, making it unclear the reason for their involvement. Despite licensee representing that she usually uses collateral forms if a client's spouse or family member joins a session, licensee failed to complete any sort of collateral forms for wife, son, or daughter. Even more concerning is that licensee represented that if she knows the family members is going to attend one session, she will not complete a collateral form, yet licensee has no way of knowing whether the family member will attend another session in the future. It appears licensee failed to define each participant's role in the client's therapy. Following a review of the investigative record, it also appears to be a violation of ARS 3232516L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice in the licensee's profession. This recommendation is based on, during the course of client's treatment, client disclosed suicidal ideation several times during sessions with licensee. An 8-30-21 progress note indicated the following. Client stated he is dwelling on negative thoughts and is having some suicidal thoughts. Client stated that the negative thoughts focus on kids, marriage, and how this life is presently. Session focused on triggers, discussed breathing as a coping skill. A 2-23-22 progress note included the following. Client still struggles today with suicidal thoughts and feelings of worthlessness. Discussed internal family system. A 10-22 progress note included the following in part. The only thing that stops client from killing himself is knowing that he would hurt so many people that love him. Client knows he does not want to die but is hurting so much. Discussed that client needs to speak to his doctor about medication for depression. Client declined going to the hospital but agreed to call his parents and tell them he is coming over to stay with them until wife gets home. Client agreed to come back at 3 p.m. to talk more. Client provided his parents and wife's contact information as part of the safety agreement. Another 10-22 progress note indicated that client returned and denied any suicidal ideation. Despite client disclosing suicidal ideation during the 8-30-21 and 2-23-22 session, licensee failed to develop or document any sort of safety plan or risk assessment. Even though licensee documents there was a safety agreement during the 10-22 session, licensee failed to document specifically what the safety plan entailed, other than client would call his parents to stay with them. It is highly concerning that client disclosed suicidal ideation on multiple occasions to licensee, and licensee failed to devise a safety plan with client. Even more concerning is that the licensee felt client's statements at one point were dramatic and used that as her rationale for not completing a formal safety plan. Additionally, licensee represents she has completed formal safety plans for clients in the past when they have expressed suicidal ideation, yet failed to develop a formal safety plan for client when he expressed suicide ideation. Despite licensee's representation, she in fact failed to adequately assess client's suicidality when he expressed suicidal ideation on multiple occasions. A further concern, licensee represented she has taken continuing education courses in risk assessment and safety planning. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, it appears to be a violation of ARS 3232516II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to ARS 133620 duty to report abuse. This recommendation is based on the following. During the course of treatment with client disclosed during a therapy session that there had been physical altercations between complainant and son. An 82720 note indicated the following. Son was having issues with complainant and there were physical altercations. Son had bruises and scratch marks from the conflict between him and complainant this past week. Client showed licensee pictures of the marks on son's arms. Clients say that the complainant would get physically abusive with client when they were married. At the time of these disclosures from client, son was still a minor. Licensee represented the following in regards to why she did not report these allegations to DCS. It was hearsay to her. Licensee and client would have talked about it. I apologize. Licensee and client would have talked about how it can be reported to DCS. Licensee did not know how those bruises got there. Licensee knew son could be difficult. Licensee knows things can be thrown out of proportion and did not want to overreact to that. Son was almost 18 years old. It is concerning that licensee represented she did not report alleged child abuse to DCS because it was hearsay and new things could be thrown out of proportion. As a mandated reporter, licensee is obligated to report allegations of child abuse if she becomes aware of possible abuse during the course of services. Additionally, licensee represented she did not know how the bruises got there, showing more reason for licensee to report to DCS to allow DCS to fulfill their duties by investigating the allegations of possible child abuse. Licensee's representation that son was almost 18 years old is highly problematic, being that the statutory requirements for mandated reporting do not outline any sort of exemption to reporting if a child is almost 18 years old. It is not licensee's role or responsibility to determine what should or should not be reported to DCS. Licensee, in fact, failed to report allegations of child abuse to DCS as a mandated reporter. Even more concerning is that licensee represented she has taken continuing education courses regarding mandated reporting and has made DCS reports in the past. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be a violation of ARS 32-3251-16X, exploiting a client, former client, or supervisee. This recommendation is based on the following. Within licensee's response to the board complaint, she provided an undated letter written by client attesting to certain complaint allegations. This undated letter written by client included the following in part. Client recently saw licensee and she informed him that the complainant had filed a complaint against her for seeing daughter in a session on 10/19/23 without permission. Licensee and client had talked about parenting with daughter in previous sessions. Client asked licensee if he could bring daughter in for a session with him. Client did not let daughter know ahead of time that they were going to see licensee. When they went into session, daughter was upset and did not want to talk, and licensee asked daughter if she would talk to her if client left the room. Client provided his recollection of the events of that day regarding the 10/19/23 session. Daughter and client are trying to create a positive relationship and complainant does not like that. Client's wife and him are not having issues. In regards to licensee calling daughter a brat and telling her she was responsible for any problems in client's marriage, daughter did not mention any of those things to client that day. Licensee acknowledged informing client of the board complaint and that the complainant alleged that licensee called daughter a brat and the complainant had full decision making. Licensee cannot recall if she allowed client to read the full complaint, but told client she had to respond to the complaint. Licensee cannot recall if client offered to write the letter, but client have mentioned that he could write a letter and licensee agreed. Licensee did not view this letter as a client exploitation, but rather saw it as a way of gathering all necessary information and felt this point of view would be beneficial. Despite licensee representing that client may have been one to offer the letter, licensee inappropriately involved client in a board's investigative process when, in fact, the board complaint notices clearly indicate that the board complaint is confidential and should be treated as such. Licensee inappropriately used client's testimony as a board defense for her own benefit because she felt this point of view would be beneficial. Additionally, following the investigative report, a violation of ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards as developed by the board as it relates to consent for treatment plan, client record, and financial and billing records. From 8/17 to 4/23, client signed several informed consents that failed to include four board minimum requirements. From 10/17 to 5/24, licensee completed eight treatment plans for clients, which included a review date section but was left blank on every treatment plan. A 10/19/23 progress note failed to include licensee's dated signature. Despite all other progress notes meeting all board minimum requirements, all notes since 1/19 were electronically signed by licensee on 6/26/24, 5 years later. Board rules require progress notes to be signed and finalized contemporaneously, which means 10 days from the date of service. Upon review of the billing records, licensee drafted a progress note on 6/26/24 and failed to maintain any sort of billing record for this service. It is highly concerning that licensee has been in private practice since 2004 and failed to ensure her clinical documentation met all minimum board requirements. Furthermore, in 2020 and 2022, licensee completed license renewal applications, which required her to complete the board's tutorial regarding statutes and regulations, which specifically provided education and training on clinical documentation standards. Since being notified of her documentation deficiencies, licensee has provided updated forms that now meet all of board's requirements. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Anybody has any questions? Any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? Okay, no questions. So, Ms. Are you, you're the licensee?
Yes, I'm okay. Leslie Whiting.
All right. So you have up to 11 minutes to address the board.
Okay. Well, I own completely that some of my documentation was not up to par, that I did not identify specifically what I had done for suicidal ideations. I do a thorough suicide assessment at each session. If someone says that they are suicidal, I did not document that. I'm in error of that. In regards to the him writing his letter, I did not show him the complaint. I did not ask him to write the letter. And he did that on his own. I even consulted with a few of my colleagues in regards to should I include this or not include this. And the kind of the consensus that I got was it'd probably be good for them to hear all sides of the story of what happened. When they left my office that day, they were smiling. They were in a good place. The complainant came in later, was very upset because she did not know that the daughter was coming in. I informed the father, the daughter, all that were in the mother that I would not see the daughter ever again. In regards to not having, when the father has brought the daughter in, or the father brought the son in, or the client brought his wife in, not having them sign those forms, I was under the understanding at that time that because they were coming in with my client, focus was on my client, and then their relationship, it was not addressing anything to do with the person in the room, any of their personal issues whatsoever, that I did not need to sign that form. I will do so in the future. If I was to see a client, if they were to come in on a consecutive basis, most definitely would have them sign forms. Consistently, I've done that. But when they come in and it's like a one-time session, we're going to work, the client wanted to work on this. When the son came in, I did not know that he was going to come in. When the wife came in, I did not know she was going to come in. And so, and it was working on, the session was focused on the father of the relationship. I'm not sure if I've addressed all of the issues. Oh, the reporting, the altercation. With the picture, the son was also getting ready, and I did not inform the investigator that he was getting ready to move out of the home within the next few weeks because of the conflicts between he and his mother. Did I address all of them?
I don't know. Did you address everything you wanted to tell us?
Well, let me get my notes here. Because, I know that I probably my documentation is minimal. I cover minimal. I do know that. And I can improve on that. I do understand that and take responsibility for that. As far as my not putting my clients' needs and cares first, that I wasn't aware of and attuned to the suicidal ideation, I was very clear where I knew this client very well. A big part of being a therapist is being able to assess what's going on. And I did that. I used my assessment. I went through, why don't you want to? What's going on? What would you do? What are the plans? Never did he have a plan until the very last one. And even then, he didn't have a plan. He came into my office in the middle of the day. I was in the middle of a session. He interrupted a session. He was very upset. And I went through, here's what we've got, what we're going to do. He came back then at the end of that day. when he had calmed down and had spoken with his parents and his wife and was said, no, I know I don't want to hurt myself. Okay. So I felt like that had been covered adequately.
Okay, thank you. Any board members have questions for the licensee? I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you've been practicing for a while.
Yes.
So about how long has your documentation been minimal?
I don't know. In all honesty with you, I think that my documentation, what I always make sure of, individual session with client reported wanting to focus on this, you know, what we did in session and their response. I do a pretty simple, you know,
minimal.
But I don't always document. I do a pretty simple soap note. Mm-hmm. I don't always document, you know, he said this, I said this, thought this. So example being in the one note that they mentioned that the process thoughts and feelings. In that process of thoughts and feelings, I'm doing an assessment. What's going on? How are you doing? Tell me your thoughts in regards to this. In the one in regards to the educated on IFS, spend a great deal of time in regards to talking about the different parts and how that cognitive distortion impacts their thoughts and feelings and their interaction with any suicidal ideation and looking at those kinds of things. And so I know I did do those things. Did I document that completely? No.
And you have renewed your license several times.
Yes.
Right? And you have taken the tutorials.
Yes.
And when you take the tutorials, do you go back and check that what you have learned the tutorials is what you're practicing?
Yeah. And, mm-hmm.
You do or you haven't?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I have. Yes. Okay. Things that I've learned in the tutorial, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think that's all I have. Anybody else has any questions? Yes, Mr. Charles.
I don't feel like you adequately, remotely touched on failure to report the child abuse.
Yeah, child abuse.
Your reference was that you felt that the son was sometimes difficult and that was near 18. Child abuse is okay?
No.
Son difficult?
Never okay. I will tell you that I've known this family. I've known what happens. I do know that things get blown out of proportion. Things get misrepresented often. And so I would err on the cautiousness on that one. I knew that the son was getting ready to move out. I knew that there was none of the other children that were in the home with the mother had any altercations ever. It was always just this one son. And I knew that he was getting ready to move out. You know, if there was any children at risk is big. I would not do anything to put a child at home. If a child told me that a parent was doing something, if it was in a divorce situation, I would call to make sure that they were going home to the parent that was not complaining about the safer parent. And then on this one, and I would talk to that parent and with the child and go through a solid safety plan and reporting the DCF. And I have done that. But no, is it because he was almost 18? No. I think my thinking was he's moving into his grandmother's house. And that the other children had not ever been any information on any of the other children being in altercations with the mother.
Any other question?
I do have a question.
Dr. Kruger.
What training do you have in working to work with families? What's your training in working with families?
I've done Gottman training. I've done Sue Johnson's training. I've done both of those extensively.
Any training that's just outside of couples work?
in regards to
working with families.
I've done a lot of systems, family systems work early on, and did a lot of that.
Training in it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have a couple questions for you. How many clients are currently on your caseload?
How many? I see maybe about 15 to 20 a week anymore.
Okay. Do you supervise?
No.
Okay. Do you have anybody that you like seek consultation from or anything like that?
Very much so. There's about 12 therapists in our office that we work with.
Okay.
And we consult with each other frequently.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you could walk me through your ethical decision-making model, like when you're working with multiple clients, I'd like to kind of hear that from you.
Well, part of what I do, if somebody brings a partner or child in with them and I'm not aware of it, first thing that I do is we identify why they're here and what they want to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, then the session will focus on that. At the end of that session, what I would do typically is either refer them to somebody else because it looks like you could do some individual stuff on your own, and then have them give them referrals for that if that is necessary, or couples therapy. In this situation, I remember telling the son, probably be good for you to get some individual counseling, you know, and gave him recommendations for that.
Okay. So typically with like situations like this, it sounds like you are almost unaware that these individuals are coming in before they come in.
The daughter, I was aware. He asked the session before, can I bring her in? Because we're not talking. Can I bring her in? I try to talk to her. We had worked on several different parenting things that he could do differently. And I said, okay.
Okay.
So I did know she was coming in.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any further? Oh,
yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I have a few questions as well. What populations do you usually serve?
Older. I work with adults primarily.
Okay. Do you usually, do you work with children frequently or?
You know, early on in my practice, I used to work with a lot with teens and children, like probably 10 and up. Anymore, I do not. I work primarily with population probably mid 20s on up.
Okay. And then what is your understanding of your responsibility as a mandated reporter?
If there is any question of someone being in harm or harming themselves or in harm's way.
And then you had answered a little bit about, you know, through your SOAP note, your assessment for suicidality. Do you use any formal risk assessments for assessing for suicidality?
I have used formal forms.
Do you know what they're called or no? Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think those are my questions. Thank you.
All right. So no further questions. Ms. Gross, you have this case. So for now, we're going to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt.
Okay. some things that I just want to quickly note, because like it was before we even get into kind of making a motion, because this was brought up as far as like the documentation deficiencies, and I just feel like this should be mentioned for the public and our members, is that if it's not documented, it didn't happen.
Ever.
So, you know, for example, if something terrible does happen to our clients and it's not documented, then it never happened, right? So that's a huge risk, not only to the client, but also to our own licenses. I reviewed this case multiple times, and I do agree with board staff, but I want to see if any other board members have anything else they'd like to add before I make a motion.
Yeah, I have a few comments. When we're talking about collateral contacts forms and collateral contacts, children, generally speaking, cannot be a collateral contact.
Absolutely.
That would look like if you need to bring in your child, that would be family therapy. Refer to a family therapist to address concerns between you and your minor child. The other thought that I have was in regarding to mandated reporting, that it's our responsibility as mandated reporters to report regardless of where a child lives. If we hear of suspected abuse, we have to. It's not our job to know if, you know, they're safe or not. We have suspicion. We report regardless. And there was a comment made that I want to address of knowing, well, if their parents are separated or divorced and they're going to one parent, then I try to have the other parent that they're not afraid of to go home with them. Well, we don't know what the custody agreements are all the time, mm-hmm. and that's not always possible. And so we have to also be careful because there may be some legal stipulations about custody time that we can't, as therapists or professionals, make that decision. Those are my comments for now.
Any other comments before I make a motion? Okay. I'd like to make a motion to find for the following violations. ARS 32-3251 16K with a dot 8 multiple clients. ARS 32-3251 16. Is that I or L?
No.
L. Okay. L. ARS 32-3251 16II. Along with ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse. ARS 32-3251-16X. And then for client exploitation. And then ARS 32-3251-16P for documentation deficiencies.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A motion carries.
Okay. My first initial thoughts on this, obviously I'm open to anybody else's thoughts as well, is I'd like to do a 24-month consent agreement with a state suspension. I would like to require clinical supervision. This is kind of where my question, it gets a little dicey on the frequency. My initial thought is to do 4 times a month for the first year, followed by a second year, at least 2 times a month at the clinical supervisor's discretion. What do you guys think of that? Any thoughts, any additions, changes?
One thought is, and I don't know, Toby, if this would be a question for you, with the state suspension, we're looking at the level of egregiousness, and does this rise to the level of egregiousness that we need a state suspension for it?
I believe so, because we're looking at the fact that we didn't report abuse of a minor, and we also did not properly assess suicidality.
Okay, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Then I don't know if I would do the 4 times a month, because if for any reason, not maybe the licensee's part, but if the clinical supervisor says, I can't meet for this week, now she's out of compliance with hers. So they're bound by the schedule of the clinical supervisor. See what I mean? So that's like weekly, meeting weekly.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Zavala, if that happens, as long as they report that and document, and it's not like a regular practice, right? Like if the licensee or the report says, you know, we couldn't meet on this week because whatever, I was in the hospital or the supervisor was on vacation, right? That gets reported. Is that correct?
Right. So correct in saying that. So when somebody is under a consent agreement, they're through compliance, and the board definitely has flexibility, you know, to be accepting and accommodating to certain types of requests. Sometimes it could be the licensee that goes on vacation for a couple of weeks, or the clinical supervisor. So there's definitely some flexibility there. You know, the state suspension, you know, I think when you have the the suicide, you know, piece to it, and the failure to report piece to it, that's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it's up to the board if they put the state suspension on, but there is that flexibility. It's just knowing that whatever is stipulated in the consent agreement, they're going to be required to do and held responsible to do. And if not, then that state will get lifted and their license will be suspended.
Something in the clinical supervision that I'd like to also mention, I was thinking of practice administrator to make sure documentation, but that might be very redundant with the clinical supervisor, but ensuring that all the documentation is up to board standards.
Okay.
I don't know if practice monitor, what you all think about that, or if that's going to be too much with the clinical supervisor.
I don't know. I think that that may be appropriate because of the documentation seems to be so casual, right? Like, I don't think that there's a full understanding of our documentation.
Yeah.
And the things that we need to have. And, you know, if you don't document it, you never did it.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
So
I would agree with that. How long would we want to do the practice monitor for?
Madam Chair, could I make some comments about that just for you to consider? You know, in this particular case, if you're going to require somebody to get, you know, weekly clinical supervision, I think what might make a little bit more sense, I think a practice monitor, you know, does make sense, but that's pretty extensive, recognizing, you know, the egregiousness of the case. But I think what you could consider doing instead is if you're going to do weekly clinical supervision, have that clinical supervisor be required to randomly audit, you know, three files each session or one file. We've done that before because as a clinical supervisor, part of your job is to be looking through the clinical record, making sure things meet. But you could maybe put an additional responsibility that she's randomly selecting other files that they're not discussing. And again, that's just a thought. Having a practice monitor on top is typically we only do a practice monitor if we have issues with documentation and not clinical care.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
And, okay.
Yeah. And so I incorporate it within that clinical supervision.
Yeah. I can agree with that. I was even thinking of like shifting it around as, you know, practice monitor and then maybe 2 week clinical supervision. But I think if it's covered, I just want that documentation piece covered. Okay. So I'm just making sure it meets BBHG standards.
Yeah, I like the idea of auditing random charts during that time. So I think that that's like a really good idea. Some other things, and this it's kind of going to get a little dicey here because I'm going to bounce around just a little bit. As far as the clinical supervision, and the CEUs that we discuss, and I've got a list of those here. I'd like to require that at least the CEUs are completely in person, and maybe we do a couple in-person clinical supervisions a month, because there is some note in there that we had completed some training on, like, suicidal ideation and even the board's tutorial. I want to make sure that we have that in-person discussion piece, you know, so that we're, you know, fully focused on things that we're learning in these courses. I think that's extremely important and essential.
So, did you say what kind of CEUs in person?
I will get to that.
But I missed it.
So, I would like 3 in ethics. I thought 3 in just suicidal ideation, but I actually really like the idea of doing the assist training. I think that that's a really like great idea and would be really beneficial. Doing 3 CEUs in documentation, 3 in mandated reporting, 3 in high conflict families, and attend a board meeting. So 5 hours of that. Anybody have any other education that they would want to add or disagree with anything?
I actually had written down in ethics as well, but mine was with a focus on the ethics of in working with families.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think that's good. I think I would probably just separate them because, like, I think there's some other ethical issues that are kind of going on there, especially with like documentation and a couple other things. So I think like separating ethics from the conflict, the high conflict families would make sense.
Okay. I was thinking the ethics of working with families.
Okay.
And then high conflict families.
Oh, so doing ethics of families and then high conflict. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. I don't know if any board members know. For example, like a graduate level course in ethical practices, would those cover some of these issues like working with families and kids and reporting and documentation?
I think if it was a graduate level course for marriage and family therapists, then you're going to have an ethics class that is focused on family systems.
So would that suffice?
Yes. Yes.
Can we ship that?
Sure. Yeah, that works.
Ms. Zavala, did you get that?
I just want to make sure. So the 3-credit graduate level course in marriage and family laws and ethics, what is that going to replace?
It's going to replace ethics and
both
high
ethics?
Conflict families.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So 6 combined.
Yeah. Next thing that I want to discuss is a little bit is just the focus of clinical supervision and what we want focused on during that time with the clinical supervisor. So some things that come to mind are multiple clients, suicidal assessment and safety planning, conflict of interest, boundaries, duty to report, and I would like the clinical supervisor to discuss and review the CEUs that she's taking and talk about that within the supervision, so kind of what she's gained from it and what she's learned and kind of expand on that.
As well as reviewing the documentation for deficiencies.
Yes.
Yeah, the audit practice mm-hmm. monitor piece.
Yes.
That sounds great.
Ready?
We're ready.
Okay. So we'd be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 24 months. There'd be a stayed suspension. She would be required to take her CEUs in person, which would cover 3 CEUs in behavioral health ethics, the 2-day assist training, 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation, 3 CEUs in mandated reporting, 5 CEUs in attending a board meeting, a 3-credit graduate level course in family law and ethics. She also would be required to get clinical supervision. The first 12 months would be 4 times. 2 of those 4 times must be in person. After the first 12 months, at the recommendation of the clinical supervisor, it can be lessened, but no less than 2 times monthly. The focus would be on suicide risk assessment, mandated reporting, boundaries, Arizona documentation, multiple clients, statutes and rules. There would be discussion regarding the required CEUs taken, as well as random chart audits. If not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing.
That is my motion.
Palacios, second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
All right. Thank you. So this concludes the case. If you have further questions, you can contact your investigator next week. Next will be item 7B, Jacqueline Kaplan. Is the complainant here? You can come to the front. And is the licensee here? Oh, okay. We're going to have the complainant up here first. We're going to have the complainant up front first. So we're going to listen to summary of the case from board staff first.
I was just going to read a statement, if that's okay.
In a second. Madam Chair, members of the board, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following section of the NASW Code of Ethics. 1.06 Section C, Conflicts of Interest. This recommendation is based on the following. From approximately 618 to 224, licensee provided therapy services to mother at her private practice. From 222 to 1222, licensee provided therapy services to client and mother simultaneously. In 623, licensee also began providing therapy services to complainant. Licensee represented the following. The focus of mother sessions included addressing the dynamics of the family, including complainant, among other issues. Licensee and client would talk about mother and complainant in their sessions. Licensee and mother would also talk about her children and complainant in sessions. A 3722 note indicates mother joined client session for a family session. In a 1221-22 progress note, licensee indicated son 1 and son 2 joined for a family session and did not obtain any sort of signed consent or collateral forms for the sons to engage. Licensee denies providing any family services to this family. Licensee, in fact, failed to document how she'd be able to remain objective in treating multiple members of a family at the individual level. Furthermore, licensee failed to document anywhere in any of the client's clinical records her obligation to each individual client. Of further concern, licensee represented during her investigative interview that she did not plan on taking complainant as a full-time client. It was just for one session. This brings into question licensee's reason for accepting complainant as a client. The therapy for client and mother also focused heavily on the family and issues amongst the system, creating an area of conflict by licensee treating such family members. Licensee represented the following. Licensee asked mother for her permission to be able to treat complainant. Licensee did not define roles because she cannot do that in the first session. Licensee does not view this as a possible breach of confidentiality. Licensee, in fact, failed to define each participant's role. Additionally, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards in ethics of ethics in the behavioral health profession or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client, as it relates to the following section of the NASW, 1.06 Section D, Conflicts of Interest. This recommendation is based on the following. During board staff's investigation, it was alleged that licensee had spent time with either mother or client outside of the therapy setting. Licensee acknowledged spending time with mother and client outside of therapy and represented the following. Mother and licensee have spent time together outside of therapy when client would go over to licensee's barn. She offers this to some of her clients and their children to spend time with the horses. Licensee did not document these visits to her barn because it was not a clinical session. Licensee describes this as equine therapy, and although no license is required for it, it is something she offers from a therapeutic perspective. Client has been to licensee's barn roughly a dozen times. There was also a weekend when client stayed over at licensee's residence because the things were hectic in home and client was not an active client at the time. While mother was an active client, licensee picked up client from school as well. It's highly concerning that licensee believes simply because client was no longer her client, it was acceptable for her to allow client to stay at her personal home and come to her barn for equine therapy. Furthermore, licensee appears to lack insight into the severe boundary crossing by engaging with current or former clients in a non-therapeutic manner. Additionally, licensee acknowledged offering the option for other clients and their children to come to her barn other than mother and client. While some of these boundary issues were occurring, mother was still licensee's active client and licensee failed to document this boundary extension anywhere and represented she did not because client was not the client. Licensee had a dual relationship with both client and mother by communicating and spending time with them outside of the therapy setting by providing equine therapy to client. By licensee's admission that bringing client to her barn was not considered a clinical session, it shows licensee admitted to engaging in a non-therapeutic relationship with client. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 32-3251-16P, failing to conform to minimum practice standards, as it relates to consent for treatment, treatment plan, client record. This recommendation is based on the following. A review of licensee's clinical records for mother, complainant, and client showed various deficiencies. Although records show licensee provided therapy services to mother as early as 6/18, the consent form in mother's records is dated 4/6/20. Mother's consents were missing 9 required elements. Consent forms for complainant and client, although different than mother's, were still missing 6 required elements. Progress notes for complainant and client were missing the time spent providing the service. Progress notes for mother were missing the time spent providing the behavioral health services and her dated signature. Client's clinical record did not include a treatment plan. Despite mother's records containing a treatment plan, it was missing 3 required elements. Licensee further acknowledged that it's safe to say all of her clinical documentation she has used prior to this complaint would include the same deficiencies. Highly concerning that licensee has been at the independent level since 2012 and been in private practice for approximately 5 years, and her documentation fails to meet required elements. Additionally, there was a supplement uploaded, I believe, yesterday. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Carver from board staff?
I just have a random question. Was there agency work and private practice work done with these clients? I was reading everything over what you were talking again. It was not clear to me.
She alleged she provided services at an agency.
Okay.
Any other questions for staff? All right. So, Mr. Williams, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay. I just wanted to read the statement so that way you guys can kind of understand the timeline and how things kind of went down a little bit. The outcome of this hearing is not to put an innocent counselor to false accusations, but rather seek the truth about a situation that I have questions to, because a lot of facts and actions by this counselor leads me to believe this counselor was engaged in a lot of malpractice in counseling my wife for 15 years. How she left me and my family behind with no regard for my children's feelings or my own. The fact that my children have confided in me about the counseling sessions that rocked my soul to the core, I now seek answers to what really happened. My aim is to figure out what this counselor told my wife to do, and I'll say it again, what did this counselor tell my wife to do? If this counselor believes I was cyber-stalking and changing passwords to my wife's accounts and then believed I was doing the same thing to her as well, then one's got to wonder, how did this all go down and what role did the therapist play in the level of destruction my wife threw our way? The hardest part is watching my kids wonder where their mother is and what she's doing at the present time. So I asked, did Jackie aid and abet the process of my wife? Because I can't get over what my kids have told me and the counseling session she had with Jackie. In one of the counseling sessions, Jackie had asked if I was recording her. Then anything I brought up about my wife's issues, she would cut me off and change the topic. And then repeatedly asked me if I was cheating on my wife. I don't know if people know or understand or what it feels like to be accused of things and awful actions you have never committed when you were a very faithful husband. I was a loving father who worked every day, about 8 to 16 hours a day, putting food on the table, running my own company. This is something that my wife agreed to be a stay-at-home mom. And let's see. I will tell you that when my wife left, I was more than lost, and I couldn't make sure that the woman that I loved for 15, 16 years was okay. As a child, I'd been homeless, locked up, abandoned, and by my father at a young age. Nothing compared to the mental torture I went through with my wife abandoning us the way she did. And I just can't help but look at some of the facts that JK was involved in somehow or some way. I have extensive training in sales and about 4 years of counseling under my belt, and can read people in a conversation more than 15 or 30 minutes long. In a counseling session I had with Jackie, left me feeling she was fishing for ammo to feed to my wife and not trying to mend a situation but make it worse. Paranoid actions of my wife and this therapist made me think that they both were on drugs and living in a made-up reality they conjured together. So I would ask the board to look over these sessions and cross-examine JK to see her state of mind and her counseling techniques to make sure this doesn't happen to another family. Maybe JK isn't fully responsible, I get that, but she certainly didn't help any situation in the way she counseled my wife. I know this because rather than guide me through my emotions to make my own decision, she tried to tell me several times, not once though, but all the years, she tried to tell me what to do several times instead of trying to counsel me through my emotions. Not once in all the years I've been counseled did a counselor tell me what to do, but rather walk me through my emotions to help me deal with my feelings to make educated decisions. So I ask once more, dive into what JK methods are and how she counsels people to make sure that she is of sound mind to guide other human beings. Is JK capable of believing a client so much to where she can try to indoctrinate their children into hate their father, to get their children to believe that their father is a cyber stalker, a narcissist, a gaslighter. This is what my children were told about their father. And I want to reiterate that the mother is no longer in the picture, and I am taking care of all of my children, our children, all by myself, and trying to run a company while being slandered by my ex-wife and saying I'm a narcissist who has indoctrinated the children to hate their mother. But all my wife's actions say otherwise. And keep in mind, the mother doesn't make contact with the children, not even on Christmas, birthdays, holidays. She has dropped out completely. I have proven over and over she does not want them. And if my wife spreads this many lies and does not make contact with her or her children, shouldn't a counselor be able to see through that?
Is that time up?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Sorry, I haven't spoken in front of people in a long time, so a little nervous.
Thank you. Yeah, you did good. Thank you. And just so you know, we have read all the documents that have been submitted for this complaint. Does anybody have any questions for the complainant? No questions? Okay. So now this is going to be time for the licensee to come forward to address the board. The licensee, you can come to the front. Good. Have a seat so you can be on the microphone.
Thank you. Is there somebody reading from the packet that you got?
Can you have a seat?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And just make sure you're close to the microphone. Yeah, get it closer to you. Okay. This time is for you to address the board, and you have up to 5 minutes to do so.
Okay, but I have a question. Was the gentleman, Jared Carver, were you the one who read what the case was about? Okay. Because I thought he had it, and I was told that he didn't get that packet. So, okay, I feel a little bit better. Thank you. So I'm not sure what to say. I've watched this family go from Mr. William being a non-participating father to a family that was being torn apart by lies, manipulation, gaslighting, you can call it, and being the blame of I'm the one that's breaking up their family by ghosting their children, ruining their children, to hate their father, who haven't even been in my company since December of last year. So how I can be doing all of that from my office and from my own space in my life, it seems impossible. So basically, I don't even really know what to say. I'm a little upset because I didn't receive that packet until 7 o'clock last night because somebody overlooked sending it to me, but that's okay. I'll get by. I don't know. I mean, am I allowed to use the complainant. Am I allowed to use his diagnosis here?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. That's why I'm glad I asked. I'm not letting me put myself into trouble. Thanks.
So this time is for you to address the board, knowing that everything, all the documentation that was submitted, we have all read it.
Okay.
So if you have
I'm glad that you did because I wasn't certain if you had. And I haven't even read it because, like I said, I didn't get it until 7 o'clock last night, and I had to go get a car to get up here.
So if you have any additional comments or additional things for the board to know?
Hold on a second. Mr. William, I'm sorry, complainant who says that he's a great dad, many years ago, probably 7 years ago, mother was pregnant with a baby who died by a Krita. And that is how she and I met. She was totally traumatized. And part of the complaint was that she went through the loss of the baby all by herself. He never showed up at the hospital. They didn't talk about it for a year or so. And obviously these are words coming to me the same as he's saying the words are coming to him from his daughter about, you know, situate what she and I are talking about. Trust me, after 20 years of being a therapist, I don't disclose other information to other people. So what I'm curious about is why we're focusing on this ethics thing, which, by the way, I really want to say thank you very much to whoever read the material, whoever read that packet, because it was quite considerable. Because what happened after the complaints were made by client and by complainant, they then had me give all the information for 7 years of working with the mother. So the case kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I feel that Mr. Williams has orchestrated all of this. He has at this point in time, why his wife isn't around, he stripped her of her credit cards, of her checkbook, of any money that she had. He took her off the car insurance, health insurance, mortgage on the home, completely stripped her.
Okay, if I may interrupt.
Sure, please.
Could you focus on the findings of our investigation and speak to that versus speaking about...
Well, it's
about...
kind of difficult for me to do because the complaint that came in on a little piece of paper that said you must take a look at this particular therapist, she's not fit to do therapy, based on a one-hour session with me saying it was a terrible therapist, and then it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then a letter that was allegedly from his daughter, which was, I'm sorry, from the client, which getting as many text messages and email messages that I got from complainant, that letter could not have been written by his daughter, who at the time was 14 years old, maybe 15. She's emotionally immature. She has low intelligence.
Okay.
And there's no way she could have...
I may stop you here for a second.
I'm confused, but honestly, the whole thing, I'm confused.
Okay.
Because I'm feeling that what the complaint was, that in the 50-minute session, Mr. Williams was... Is that 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you. Any questions from board members to the licensee?
I do have a question. Ms. Kaplan, what is your understanding of dual relationships according to the Social Work Code of Ethics?
Yeah, that's a good question. My understanding of dual relationships is being in a relationship with somebody that we as the therapist are gaining from. Like, for instance, if I have a client that has a husband who is a car salesman, that I go to my client and ask if I can get a special deal from your husband because we work together. That's my basic right there is as far as my basic understanding and how I navigate myself is that if we're gaining something from a client, as a dual relationship. Now, with regards to the client, she wasn't the client of mine at the time. And I had recently gotten a horse. And I had thought that it would be really, really good to have the ability to have some of my clients that were children come in and benefit from the therapeutic healing powers of a horse. A client never worked for me. She came in and she bonded with the horse. She groomed, she mucked a little bit. And then we would sit and take, So then we would sit and take a snack in between when there was a pick her up. And again, allegedly, I'm being told by complainant that I gave her all these information about calling her father a narcissist and that he was
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, it's okay. I feel like I'm blindsided here right now, but
I just want to stick with the question.
That's fine. Okay.
Ethics. What is your What certification do you have to be providing equine therapy?
You don't need certification for it. The fact that I'm a licensed clinical social worker, I'm not selling a service. I'm providing pro bono experience with adults and occasionally a child for therapeutic purposes.
Okay, I have no further questions.
Okay. I would like to request an executive session. So it's 12:28. We're going into executive. Yes, ma'am. It's for legal advice. I make a motion to go on executive session for legal advice. Do I have
a second?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carries at 12:30. Board is back in session at 12:40, and Dr. Hennigan has left for the day. All right. So moving forward, I understand, Ms. Frigger, you have the discussion.
Before you say, I just want to make one comment because I think it's important for the public. We do, as board staff, when that report is completed, we reach out and they have 10 days to request it before the board meeting. We do have record that report was sent to her email on September 30th. Yesterday at 4:30, we did receive a phone call that she hadn't received it, so we went ahead and resent it. But then again, this morning we double checked that it was sent on 9:30 and it was. So I just want to be clear because we always want to give our licensees and or applicants, you know, plenty of time to review any information. So we did send it to the email of record.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, Ms. Krieger, Dr. Krieger.
Thank you. Before I move towards any fine for violation, I have pretty significant concerns. I have concerns with the licensee's presentation.
Can you hold on for one sec? You can come back to the front. So this is time for the board members to deliberate. Sorry, didn't mention that. And we just ask that you not interrupt. Thank you.
So I have concerns with a lack of understanding of dual relationships. Probably one of my bigger concerns is a lack of responsibility where there have been violations of regulations. But more than anything, I feel some concern about the licensee's presentation. So I wanted to hear from my colleagues on that.
Yeah, I kind of share that. Some concerns based on the presentation today. And we want to maybe continue the investigation, if everybody's okay with that. I would like to move for an interim order for a psychiatric evaluation to be completed within 60 days.
Do you want to discuss a psychiatric or a psychological?
Sure.
Yeah, I think I would prefer a psychological because I think we're going to gain more information out of that versus a psychiatric. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Right. Psychiatric, typically they're looking at like medication and all that type of stuff. Psychological, we're really looking at like the whole person and their actions and, you know, their lifestyle and all of that stuff in a lot more detail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mental health, well-being, all of that.
And the psychological then can recommend psychiatric services if needed. So I think that's okay.
So I was thinking about psychiatric because that would address more of the presenting issues. But I'm okay with a psychological. Okay, so issue an interim order for a psychological evaluation to be completed within 60 days. That's my motion.
Plus your second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then I would also like to issue an interim order for 10-panel hair follicle test to be done within 10 days.
Plus your second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Which means, Ms. Kaplan, that you will be contacted by your investigator probably as soon as next week.
Okay.
And if you have any additional questions, you can contact that person.
Okay. But I can't ask the evaluation for me. So, very cool. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And
I'm sorry. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Next item on the agenda is number 8, Assistant Attorney General's report.
Oh. You know what? Yeah, we can do it the next
time. Madam Chair, we have 15 minutes. We didn't order lunch today, so I think that there's going to be a couple of matters that don't rise to a level that we need to go into full discussion. We will move them to the November board meeting.
Right.
I agree. Where should we go next? Number 9?
Yes, please.
Okay. Number 9, applications for licensure and educational program.
Madam Chair, since our last board meeting, we have issued 338 licenses.
Thank you. Sounds higher than previous months. Can I have denials, please, counseling?
So the Council and Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 6 applications based upon the failure to take the required examination, 5 applications based upon a failure to 6 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, 5 applications based upon a failure to take the required examination, and 3 applications based upon a failure to meet minimum requirements. Total denials equaling 14.
Do I have a second?
Madeira, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Social work?
Anybody wants to do the social work?
I have it out.
Nope. Thank you. The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 10 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, and 2 applications based upon a failure to take the required examination. Total denials equaling 12.
Do I have a second?
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Marriage and Family Therapy?
I'll go ahead and read that one. The Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 1 application based on a failure to pass the required examination, and 1 application based on a failure to meet minimum requirements.
Krieger, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Addiction?
The Addiction Counselor Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 3 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, 1 application based upon a failure to take the required examination, and 1 application based upon the failure to meet minimum requirements equaling 5.
Krieger, second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Number 10, we can table for next.
Yes.
And do you want to do 11?
Yes, and we have all 3 for July, August, and September.
Okay. Do I have a motion to approve financials for July, August, and September 2024?
So moved, Miller.
Plus, who's second?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And where do you want to go next?
Madam Chair, we can go to agenda item 13.
Okay.
This is in regards to a second inactive request. First inactive request can be approved by board staff, but a second inactive request has to be approved by the board, and it's for medical reasons, military reasons, or beyond the licensee's control. Without going into detail in this particular situation, it happens to be medical. Would ask for the board to consider approving the second inactive request.
Palacios moves to approve the second request for inactive status extension.
Krieger, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And Madam Chair, if I could just handpick a few from mine that I can go real quick on. I want to spend more time on this maybe the next time around, but I do want to talk a little bit about the impaired professional program, because I do know that there's a lot of people that listen to our board meetings. And I really think that it's important that we talk about self-care with our licensees, whatever that looks like. As I say, when I present, if you can't take care of yourself, it's going to be super difficult for you to take care of your clients. And our clients are very vulnerable. You know, with that said, the board does have an impaired professional program, and that impaired professional program allows individuals that have addiction problems or individuals that have behavioral health problems that impede their ability to safely and competently practice. If they self-report themselves and come before the board, they can participate in this program, which is confidential. So it doesn't come before a board meeting. They work with board staff and make sure that they're getting the rehabilitation that they can get. But again, it's done confidential, and it'll allow them to keep practicing. We find that individuals that don't take advantage of this program when they need to find themselves with a board complaint that's pretty significant. And oftentimes, a client's care has been violated in this process. So we are going to continue to keep putting this on the agenda just to get it out there. It's another way for us to educate. I also want to share that we are going to add, which I didn't realize we didn't have, but Ms. Knapp did some research, and we didn't have a question on our board tutorial in regards to the impaired professional program. So we're going to place that on there as well, just another way to educate, to let our licensees know that's available. I am going to table agenda item B. Real quickly, update on staff changes. We have 4 new staff members today.
Yay.
Welcome.
Welcome.
2 investigators and 2 investigative assistants that replaced 2 of our investigative assistants that moved up to investigators. So we're super excited. We're now at 24 staff members. And doing really, really well. And so we have the sixth one starting on October 28th, and that will be our IT generalist position. I know a couple of the board members were able to meet him ahead of the board meeting because he currently works for the state in asset, and we've been working with him with our board for about 7 or 8 years now, and I think that it's going to be a very vital position. That is important, being that we're now one of what we call the bigger boards with the number of staff that we have. So we're pretty excited about that. Real briefly, all licensee email. We had a few little hiccups at going out through IT, but we won't even get there. The licensee email is always going to be on our board's website. Anytime somebody gets an all licensee email, it's so important to read. In this particular case, it's in regards to the counseling compact, the social work compact, as well as some other changes that directly impacted our board. So super important. I will have to tell you, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Taylor, but I think 586 individuals attempted to unsubscribe from that email, which I always find a little concerning. You know, with that said, in addition to the compacts, we also talked about the substance abuse counselors title change to addiction counselors, and we talked about the expansion of their scope to addictions. And not just substance abuse addictions. Super important for those of you that are listening online later on, just because your scope has been expanded from substance abuse to all addictions doesn't mean it's within your scope of competency. So you need to make sure that if you want to expand your scope, that you need to get the appropriate training, education, and experience to expand your substance abuse addiction scope. Our website migration, long story short, we're on Drupal 7 and we're migrating to Drupal 9. And we have to do this, mandated, don't have a choice. It's costing our board about $80,000. We have a third-party company that's doing it for us, which is a good thing. But basically on December 30th, it's going to launch and our website's going to look very different. Change is hard, but it's going to be good. And we're going to look like every other state agency, basically. So, and then last but not least, the final sunset review, not much to say about it other than it's a public document now. It's on our board's website. It's gone to the governor's office. It's gone to all of our associations, the Human Service Council. And I'm very proud to report back that a number of other executive directors from other boards have reached out to our board congratulating us, which is something we don't always do when we read other people's performance audits.
And so we should be really proud of that. And specifically, the medical board is going through their audit beginning January of 25. And the executive director personally told me that she sent it to all of her staff and said, this is what we want. Mm-hmm. So I think we should, again, should be really, really proud of that. And that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So future agenda items, if you have any items you would like to put on the agenda, contact Ms. Zavala directly. Do I do 15? Item 15, call for public comment. We okay with that? Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given public matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so, pursuant to ARS 38431.01I. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Action on public comment matter that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule the matter for future discussion at a later date. Do I have any members in the public that would like to address the board today? You sure? All right. Nobody addressing the board. Next regular meeting is scheduled for Friday, November 1st. Quick turnaround for board members. November 1st, 2024 at 9 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. If you, board members, as soon as you get the email from Ms. Zavala, please take a look at each case to see if you need to recuse yourself. Do it ASAP after that. Anything else, Ms. Zavala?
Can I just get confirmation that everybody here today will be at the November 1st board meeting?
Yes, yes, yes. No, you got it. All right, so do I have a motion to adjourn at 12:57 p.m.?
Read your motion.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Meeting is over at 12:57.